but do you think you've achieved anything at all?
And a key dramatic moment.
No, every Linton on the face of the earth might perish before I forsake Heathcliff.
If only it weren't accompanied by quite so much background noise. The new series of Rewinder, starting on Saturday morning at 10:30. To listen on your smart speaker, just say play Radio 4.
This is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning. It's 6 o'clock on Thursday, the 29th of January. This is Today with Amal Rajan and Emma Barnett.
The headlines today. Sir Keir Starmer has held more than an hour of talks with China's President Xi Jinping, telling him he wants a more sophisticated relationship between the UK and China. We'll follow this story throughout the morning and take an in-depth look at the man who runs China at 8:10. And a leading backer of the assisted dying bill has told the BBC it's very difficult to see how it could become law this year amid Lords opposition.
We'll keep with that. But also in today's programme, will Londoners be riding around in driverless taxis as soon as this September? And driverless or not, if you thought your commute was a pain, what is it like to travel to the most inaccessible, unstable glacier in Antarctica? Windy, I think we can deduce from that. We will hear from one of the researchers who made the daring journey to the so-called Doomsday Glacier live from West Antarctica at 10 to 8. That's certainly a journey to take you on. I'm looking forward to that. And as the Amazon documentary on Melania Trump lands in cinemas around the world, and the West End has two productions, not one, but two, about Abraham Lincoln's wife, Mary, we'll talk about the changing role of the First Lady with Helen Lewis. But first, the BBC News is read by our First Lady, Jane Steele.
Sir Keir Starmer has told President Xi Jinping it's vital the UK and China build a more sophisticated relationship after the two leaders met face-to-face in Beijing. President Xi said ties with Britain had gone through twists and turns that didn't serve the interests of either country. The meeting is the most important part of Sir Keir's visit to the country, the first by a British Prime Minister since Theresa May in 2018. From Beijing, here's our political editor, Chris Mason.
Amid the formality and history of the Great Hall of the People, both leaders articulated a shared desire for a closer relationship. President Xi pointedly praised Labour governments for what he saw as a history of deepening ties between London and Beijing. The Prime Minister, forever aware of needing to justify what his critics see as his jaunts on the global stage, said his desire for the UK to face outwards, as he put it, reflected the reality that events abroad affect so much back home, from security to prices in the supermarket. President Xi talked of a turbulent and fluid world, the clear subtext, China a beacon of stability amid President Trump's whims, outbursts and unpredictability. But the gloss of diplomacy cannot mask the vast differences of instinct and outlook on human rights and espionage, just for starters.
A leading backer of the assisted dying bill has told the BBC it is very, very difficult to see how it could become law in England and Wales this year after the House of Lords tabled more than 1,000 amendments. The Labour peer, Lord Falconer, argued that if elected MPs had passed the bill, peers should not be able to block it, and he said he was considering the unprecedented use of powers under the Parliament Act to override the Lords. Our political correspondent Harry Farley reports.
Time is running out for the assisted dying legislation to pass before the end of this parliamentary session, expected in May. According to a government source, ministers are suggesting a compromise, such as setting up a royal commission, could provide a way forward if it doesn't pass. But the architects of the bill say they will use arcane powers under the Parliament Act to bring it back. If an identical replica bill passed the Commons a second time, peers would not be able to block it again. Critics say this would mean forcing a flawed bill into law with no ability to change it. A source close to Labour opponents of assisted dying said the threat was the act of a bully who knew they were losing the argument.
A team of scientists from the UK and Korea have set up camp on the most inaccessible section of one of the largest and most unstable glaciers in Antarctica. They plan to drill through the ice, collecting data on how warm water beneath the Thwaites Glacier is causing it to melt. The British Antarctic Survey says this is vital to estimate how quickly seas may rise worldwide. Schools in England are to be told not to automatically send children home if they are suspended. The Education Secretary, Bridget Phillipson, said being sent home could mean children retreating to social media and that on-site suspensions should be used for pupils who haven't been violent. Marianne Leake from Coram Children's Legal Centre says it's important the government considers the needs of all school children.
For children who are then isolated within school, whether it's suspensions, whether it's removal, that might be significantly more challenging for children with specific kinds of special educational need, particularly things like ADHD. And so we hope that with the school white paper, the Department for Education will take the opportunity to make sure that those children get better support rather than just being isolated in a room with no stimulation.
A major review of the state of the environment in Wales has warned it's one of the most nature-depleted places in the world, with polluted rivers and collapsing wildlife. The chair of Natural Resources Wales, which published the report, says more regulation and recycling won't be enough to fix the problems. Here's our Wales correspondent, Hul Griffith.
The findings of the review are stark. It says almost one in five species in Wales are at risk of extinction, and that poor air quality contributes to up to 1,400 premature Welsh deaths a year. According to Natural Resources Wales, the government-sponsored watchdog behind the review, incremental reforms are no longer enough and changes are needed in everything from transport and heating to food consumption and land use if Wales is to remain a place where people and nature can thrive side by side.
New figures show that production of vehicles in the UK last year fell to its lowest level since 1952. The Society of Motor Manufacturers and Traders says just under 765,000 left production lines in 2025, a decline of 15% compared with the year before. Here's our business correspondent, Theo Leggett.
In 2025, the UK's automotive industry suffered what the SMMT's chief executive called its toughest year in a generation. Output was badly hit by the cyber attack at Jaguar Land Rover. There was deep uncertainty over trade with the United States, and the closure of Vauxhall's van plant in Luton severely affected production of commercial vehicles. The SMMT is expecting an improvement next year. It says output could recover to 1 million vehicles annually by 2027, but only if the government meets commitments to reduce what it calls the UK's stubbornly high cost of energy.
The electric car maker Tesla has experienced its first ever annual decline in revenue. It went down 3% in 2025, and profits in the final quarter were 61% lower compared with the same period the year before. Tesla says the company will end production of two of its models and shift towards AI-driven projects such as Optimus robots and self-driving robo-taxis.
Jane, thank you very much indeed. More on that at 10 to 7. But now let's get the weather with Sarah Keith Lucas. Hi, Sarah.
Good morning to you, Amal. Well, today's weather is looking quite chilly, quite grey for many of us as well, more cloud than we had yesterday. And we're starting off with some fairly dense fog patches too, and still a lot of flood warnings out, mainly across parts of southern England. We've also got one severe flood warning for the lower River Stour in Dorset. But let's start with the detail for South East England, Eastern England, the Midlands, North Wales, North West England, South West Scotland and Northern Ireland. Thankfully, today is looking predominantly dry across this region. It is a chilly start, temperatures not far from freezing, and some dense fog too. That's going to slowly clear away from the Midlands and southern England over the next few hours. And then later this morning, a few brighter spells around, but generally large amounts of cloud. And it's not going to feel particularly warm with temperatures around 6 to 8 degrees here. South West England and South Wales, there are a few more showers around this morning. Nothing too widespread or heavy. They're pretty hit and miss, but you might just catch one or two. Later in the afternoon, then more persistent rain rolls in from the southwest. The winds are going to be picking up later too. 8 or 9 degrees the top temperature here, but those showers and then the rain later are falling on saturated ground, so we could see some ongoing flooding issues here. For North East England, as well as Eastern Scotland and Northern Scotland, a cloudy day with a chilly southeasterly wind bringing a few showers around. They're hit and miss for Northern England. More persistent snow showers continue once again for Eastern Scotland, so those snow totals really mounting up for parts of central Grampian, for instance, and a few showers up towards the Northern Isles too. Top temperatures here, a chilly 4 to 6 Celsius.
Sarah, thanks very much. It's 6:09. Let's have our first look at the papers and through the headlines and what's making waves across the news websites. If we go now to look at President Trump's threat to Iran, it's covered by almost all of the front pages. Countdown to conflagration is the Daily Mail's headline. The Guardian says the threat of a US-Iranian war appeared to loom closer following Mr. Trump's warning. According to the Daily Mirror, he is said to be considering targets including weapon caches and members of the Revolutionary Guard. The I newspaper says it has learned that Iranians are fleeing the capital. The front of the Financial Times has a picture of what it calls an anti-American poster in Tehran. It appears to show explosions on the deck of an aircraft carrier with the slogan, "If you sow the wind, you'll reap the whirlwind."
Many papers cover Sir Keir Starmer's trip to China. The Sun focuses on a deal designed to cut the flow from China of boat parts and engines used by migrants for channel crossings, with Sir Keir saying it will cut off supply at source. The Daily Express is scathing in its analysis of the Prime Minister's meeting with President Xi. It describes Sir Keir coming face to face with one of the world's most powerful leaders as the greatest mismatch of our time. But the Mirror's editorial says the Prime Minister is right to engage with China in what it calls grown-up diplomacy, which involves doing business without selling our soul.
The Times says Sir Keir has vetoed plans for a new attempt to change the benefits system as Number 10 seeks to avoid another confrontation with Labour MPs. The paper says the Department for Work and Pensions has been unsuccessful in including its bills in the King's Speech, which sets out the government's legislative agenda. But officials say final decisions on its contents have not been made.
The Investment Minister, Lord Stockwood, has told the Financial Times that there are discussions within government about introducing a universal basic income for workers in sectors that are likely to be wiped out by artificial intelligence. He tells the paper there's a need to think really carefully about how to soft land those industries that go away.
It's 11 minutes past six. Sir Keir Starmer, as you've been hearing, is in Beijing. It's day two of a three-day trip. It's the first time a UK Prime Minister has visited China since 2018. That was Theresa May. Today's key moment is his meeting with President Xi, which finished just before we came on air. The leaders spoke to each other in the Great Hall of the People, where the British Prime Minister, slightly off mic, outlined his approach to the relationship between the two countries.
This is a historic visit. The first by a British Prime Minister in 8 years. Now, we've made this trip because I believe it is strongly in our common interest to find positive ways to work together. And that has been our long-standing position.
Much of that, of course, going to be behind closed doors, but the images coming out of that meeting are certainly very powerful and striking. You can see that and have a live feed also from our website. But Stephen McDonnell, our China correspondent, what can you tell us of that meeting?
Yeah, well, we're also getting a bit of a readout of what they said, which might assist listeners, because, as you say, it's a bit hard to hear from that recording. But Keir Starmer said to Xi Jinping that China is a vital player on the global stage, so it's vital to build a more sophisticated relationship between the two countries where we can identify opportunities to collaborate, but also allow for a meaningful dialogue in areas where we disagree. Now, obviously, that refers to human rights abuse allegations, etc., etc. Xi Jinping, in turn, also sort of referred to this, but said that China and Britain need to rise above these differences to find areas where they can cooperate. He spoke about the international situation experiencing massive changes and turbulence. Well, no kidding. And obviously, that's a bit of a reference to the Trump administration, it seems. Xi Jinping said to Keir Starmer that his visit's getting a lot of attention here, that good things take time and effort, and as long as something's the right thing to do and serves the fundamental interests of our countries and peoples, well, we should get on with it. And so a lot of positive talk, but really what people will be looking for is later on in the day when they're going to announce a series of deals and what they actually come to. I mean, what concrete increases in trade might happen between the UK and China, and it could be electric vehicles, pharmaceuticals, agricultural products, you know, many, many areas. There are a lot of businesses have visited here, and it seems a lot of these MOUs are going to be signed.
Stephen McDonnell, we'll keep with this, what the meeting, what we know of that meeting and how the rest of that trip is going to go. And as you say, the proof for some will be in the details of that deal. Stephen McDonnell there, our China correspondent. Thank you.
14 minutes past six, just before 8 o'clock on this programme, in fact, 10 to 8, we're going to be hearing from a British scientist who's close to the Thwaites Glacier in West Antarctica. This is an extraordinarily important part of the snowy landscape of Antarctica because it's very, very deep, and British scientists have done a better job of getting underneath that glacier than anyone has ever before, which allows them basically to look at the ocean currents there and understand the nature of global heating. Justin Rowler is the BBC's climate editor. Justin, why is the Thwaites Glacier so important?
The Thwaites Glacier, it's known as the Doomsday Glacier, which is gives you a clue to just how worried people are about it. It's a flow of ice in the West Antarctic. The West Antarctic is a basin, huge basin of ice. And the crucial thing about it, it sits in the water. So at some points, it's up to 2 kilometres deep. And then there's another 2 kilometres of ice above it. So the Thwaites Glacier is a moving stream of ice within that. And it sits in the middle of the West Antarctic Basin. So it's like a kind of cork in a frozen bottle. It's the fastest move, one of the fastest moving large glaciers in the world. Satellite measurements show that it's melting quicker and quicker. And the idea of this expedition, which is actually onto the main trunk, the main bit of this glacier, full of crevasses and one of the fastest moving parts of the glacier, they're camping on top of it. And they're going to use hot water to drill down through the ice, a full kilometre down to the grounding point. That's the point where the glacier lifts off the ground. Warm water comes in, melts it from below, and it lifts off and becomes a floating ice shelf. That's where the most sort of dynamic, if you like, part of the glacier, where warm water comes in, where it's melting, and they want to put technology down there that can measure the currents, measure the flow of water, measure the temperature, and try and understand better what is driving the melting of this vast body of ice.
It is an extraordinary achievement for British scientists, isn't it? And indeed British science, because to drill that deep to get to those warm currents is something that's never been done before.
They have masterminded a kind of drilling technique that involves digging huge volumes of snow, putting them in a kind of small swimming pool. They use kerosene burners to heat it up. They raise the temperature to about 90 degrees Celsius, and then that is used to spray down into the ice and melt their way down about a metre a minute, 1,000 metres, as you say, through the ice. In this case, they can do up to 2,000 metres. But as you say, yeah, this is a kind of technology that's been pioneered by UK scientists at the British Antarctic Survey, and allows access to these, you know, otherwise totally inaccessible points on ice flows around the world. So yeah, really vital technology for understanding, of course, because at the heart of all of this is sea level rise. And if Thwaites alone is, I think, 65 centimetres of global sea level rise, the entire West Antarctic Basin, were it to melt out, would be more than 3 metres of sea level rise. We're talking devastating flooding to low-lying towns and cities across Britain. So this is vital to understanding the processes driving that sea level rise.
Justin, our climate editor, thank you very much indeed. It is 17 minutes past six. Let's say good morning to Fliss Hannah, who's got the business news from Salford. Good morning, Fliss.
Good morning, yes. And we're going to stick with that news we've been hearing, that Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer has been meeting with China's President Xi Jinping just in the last few hours, and saying he wants a more sophisticated relationship with the country. So what might it mean for British business? Because we've already heard just this morning from Xi Jinping, he said after that meeting that mutual trust is the bedrock for enduring relations, and that China and Britain should expand cooperation in areas including education and healthcare. Well, businesses in both countries will be watching that visit very, very closely and all the comments. So let's cross to Beijing now and talk to Graham Wallace, who's Managing Director at the British Chamber of Commerce in China. Graham, good morning.
Good afternoon from Beijing.
Oh, good afternoon. 8 hours ahead, absolutely. What are you hoping will be the outcome in terms of business and trade from this visit?
Well, obviously, we are hoping for some concrete outcomes, not just talk. We're hoping for progress on market access issues we've long raised. For example, tariffs on spirits, tariffs on active pharmaceutical ingredients. We're also hoping for some progress on the granting of qualifications, of licenses. We really have a whole long list of kind of market access wins we are hoping the Prime Minister will advance that ultimately will create more opportunity for businesses here on the ground. Flipping that, we're also hoping for the announcement of deals from Chinese companies into the UK. For us on the ground here, one of our biggest constituents of business is the service sector, and our members in that sector, they see a lot of opportunity, not just in doing more business here, but in assisting Chinese companies on their investment journey into the United Kingdom and other third markets.
Well, that's an interesting point, isn't it? Because the UK imports much, much more than it sells to China. The trade deficit between the two countries has doubled since 2019. Does that trouble you? Should that trouble us?
I mean, that is obviously the deficit in goods. We are a services superpower. And perhaps I think that kind of difference in the makeup of our economy kind of reflects how our members feel. All the major chamber of commerces in Beijing and China survey their members, and you'll find much more optimism from the British community relative to, say, the Europeans or the Germans, who perhaps rely a little bit more, say, on trading goods than us Brits, who, say, are stronger in that service sector.
Now, we can't talk about international trade without mentioning Donald Trump. How much influence is he having on trade with China and on the importance of perhaps increasing our trade with China?
Well, even for British companies, we can't escape US-China trade tensions. 50% of our members in a recent survey cited US-China trade tensions as the main geopolitical risk. While the majority of our members were unaffected by the kind of up and down yo-yo tariffs, the few who were manufacturing in China to export into America, obviously that impact was huge and not far off existential at times.
Now, many people have concerns about China's human rights record, and we'll be hoping the Prime Minister addresses some of those concerns on this visit. From your members' perspective, do you have any concerns or worries about China's business practices?
I would say we don't specifically ask our members on those questions, but ever since this government has come in, ever since David Lammy first came out here, they've had that consistent message of a dual focus on security, on engagement, and we kind of we trust our partners in the government to walk that fine line.
Well, help them walk that fine line then. Tell me, as someone operating in China, as somebody speaking to so many businesses operating in China, what should the government be considering as part of any future deals or trade agreements?
Well, I think there are obviously areas for investment that are more or less sensitive. And I guess you're increasingly sensitive and increasingly apprehensive in those that are deemed a security risk, a vital sector, but then more open to those that have less strategic risk. For example, I think we're expecting or hoping for announcements in the EV space, in the renewable energy space. Obviously, China is a vital, China is the world leader in new energy, everything really. So I think we'd welcome the adoption of and the import of that technology into the UK. So yeah, I would say really the government taking a sector by sector basis, not being naive, but not having to put unnecessary barriers up for major concerns, perhaps.
Graham Wallace, thank you very much. Graham Wallace, the Managing Director at the British Chamber of Commerce in China. Right, some of the biggest names in US tech have posted earnings overnight. So let's chew over them with Micah Curry, Head of Personal Finance for digital pension consolidation firm PensionBee. Micah, good morning. Meta, Microsoft and Tesla all reported expected or better than expected quarterly earnings, although we did see Tesla's annual revenue fall for the first time. These are three very big beasts. What stood out for you?
Yes, so very strong earnings from both Meta and Microsoft. The big thing that investors are focusing on is these companies spending on artificial intelligence. They are spending billions of dollars. And the big question is, are we going to see that return? So Meta has actually had a positive reaction in its share price, even though back in October, investors were not that impressed with its spending on AI. They've now accepted this, and that acceleration in AI is welcomed. Mark Zuckerberg wants to spend on poaching the best talent from peers and really on building out a fleet of data centers across the globe to provide that electricity power that AI requires. Microsoft share price slightly punished. But basically what happened to Meta back in October, where that road to AI revenue is seen as quite a bumpy ride. And then, of course, Tesla, the big pivot, it's scrapping its Model S and Model X cars, and it's going to spend more of its money on Musk's XAI company. It's calling itself a physical AI company, and it's really going to be looking at robotics and an autonomous future of those self-driving cars and taxis.
The amount spent on AI, or being planned to be spent on AI, it's absolutely eye-watering, isn't it? Meta alone planning to spend up to 97 billion quid this year, mostly on AI infrastructure. Are investors comfortable with that now? Do they see that as a race, or do they see that as there's enough of the AI pie for all these businesses?
Yes, well, Meta has some massive spending plans. In fact, it's going to nearly double its capital spending to $135 billion this year. So that's a radical increase. Investors have become a lot more comfortable with that number. What they argue is that by using AI, they can personalize content better for users, and that can drastically improve Meta's social media and advertising business. Of course, we know that AI requires the power equivalent of the output of a nuclear reactor, really that electricity to power those data centers. So it does require a lot of spend on AI infrastructure, and there's a race for the best AI talent out there.
Tesla is an interesting one as well. You've touched on it. It revealed its annual revenue fell 61% in the last 3 months. Oh, sorry, its revenue fell 61% in the last 3 months of the year, a 3% decline in total revenues, rather, for 2025. And that's the first time its annual revenue has fallen. Despite that, its shares went up. Does Tesla not have to obey the usual market forces?
Yes, it is interesting. Tesla is reeling from a number of factors, one being President Trump's decision to cancel US EV incentive schemes, and also a big fall in sales in Europe and in America as customers stand up against Musk's political stance. But what investors are doing, they are welcoming this pivot away from cars, because Tesla is losing market share to China, and welcoming the focus on Tesla building itself as a physical AI company.
Lots to watch. Micah Curry from PensionBee, thank you very much indeed. Now, the broadband operator CityFibre will cut around 450 jobs. That's nearly a third of its staff. This is according to a letter seen by the FT. It's the biggest of the altnets, building fibre networks to challenge established names like BT's Openreach. And this news comes after another altnet, G Network, collapsed earlier this month. So let's talk to Karen Egan, head of telecoms at the research provider Enders Analysis. Karen, good morning. Just sketch out what exactly it is that CityFibre does for people who've not heard of it.
Yeah, CityFibre is a slightly different model to the vast majority of the other altnets in the sector, in that it doesn't actually sell broadband to end users. It sells it through the likes of Sky and Vodafone. So it's a wholesale provider only. And because it has largely completed its lineup of wholesale customers like Sky and Vodafone, and its network build as well, The cost cutting now is really to right size its cost base in what is a cutthroat broadband market.
And that's what CityFibre says. In fact, they say as we shift our strategy from building to acquiring networks backed by our recent £2.3 billion financing, the time is right to review how we operate so we're best placed to continue through this next phase of growth. Should we not be concerned about what this means for the market? Is this simply, as you say, right sizing? They need fewer staff now that they're not building.
Certainly in the case of CityFibre, I do think that it is just a sensible strategic strategy right now. And you can't afford to have a bloated cost base in a really challenging market. The other altnets, there's nearly 100 of them, and they kind of actually go to the end users. I think they have more challenges because they are struggling to get the kind of demand from end users onto their networks to cover the outlay that they have. They've put in place for building the networks. And so I don't think that G Network is going to be the last of the altnets to have a lot of difficulty.
And what does that mean then for end users, for customers, for households, in terms of creating competition and potentially driving down prices for them?
Well, I think that competition will remain quite elevated, even where networks are no longer in the hands of retail altnets. I think that they will nonetheless, they are in place and they will be in competition to the likes of Virgin Media and to Openreach. We think the most likely outcome for altnets who need to engage in M&A in order to secure the future, that they will likely be subsumed by CityFibre perhaps and become a wholesale model, or by Nexfibre, which is an arm of Virgin Media. And so they will nonetheless be competition in networks.
So more mergers and acquisitions potentially on the way. Karen Egan, head of telecoms at Enders Analysis, thank you very much.
Felice, thank,
Fliss, thank you. It's 28 minutes past six. We'll go, as we do at this time, from business to sport. Mike's just walked in.
Emma, thank you. Good morning. We predicted yesterday that it would be a frantic night in the Champions League as the league phase concluded, and we weren't wrong.
This is João Pedro. Garnacho's in field of him. João Pedro goes for goal himself, and he scores! Could that be the goal that puts Chelsea automatically into the knockout stages of the Champions League?
It was that the result, probably the most standout one from an English point of view last night. Chelsea coming from behind with that late winner to beat the Italian league leaders Napoli 3-2. Elsewhere, Liverpool sealed third place in the table after a 6-0 home win over Karabag. Tottenham finished fourth thanks to a 2-0 win at Eintracht Frankfurt, whilst Manchester City beat Galatasaray 2-0 at home to seal eighth spot. The only English team not to qualify directly for the last 16 was Newcastle. They drew 1-1 away to the holders Paris Saint-Germain. John Murray was watching.
While this was a draw that resulted in both missing out on direct qualification for the last 16, it was certainly eventful. Newcastle goalkeeper Nick Pope spectacularly saved an early Dembele penalty, but nevertheless Vitinha soon shot the holders in front, and it looked then like Newcastle might get swamped. They hung in though. Joe Willock headed in a shock equaliser just before half-time, and in the second half, Newcastle actually gave just about as good as they got, and substitute Harvey Barnes really ought to have snatched a winner for Newcastle. The draw means it'll be either Monaco or Karabag next month for Newcastle, with the possibility of Barcelona or Chelsea after that.
The only other result concerning an English side last night saw Arsenal make it 8 wins out of 8 with a 3-2 home win over the Kazakh side Kairat. Undoubtedly, the biggest drama of the night actually came in Portugal, where Jose Mourinho's Benfica were leading 9-man Real Madrid 3-2 in injury time, but they still needed one more goal to sneak into the knockout round. They got a free kick in the 98th minute. So what do you do in that situation? Well, you send the goalkeeper up.
If they can get a goal, their season in Europe will be extended. Jose Mourinho tells them to just go for it. Might as well send his goalkeeper up there. They've got two extra players. Ornus hangs it up there. The goalkeeper's out!
Simply extraordinary. Benfica's Ukrainian goalkeeper Anatoly Trubin scoring in the 98th minute to secure Jose Mourinho's side a place in the playoffs on goal difference.
We knew that he could do it. We knew that he could do it. We were losing in Porto a couple of weeks ago, and in the last minute he went there and he almost scored. So we know that the big guy is capable of this. The quality of the service, of course, is the most important thing. You have to put the ball there. But it's an amazing goal for the guy.
Watch all the goals from last night on the BBC Sport website. And briefly away from football, in tennis, Britain's Neil Skupski and his American partner Christian Harrison are through to the final of the men's doubles at the Australian Open after winning their semi-final overnight. There was also victory for Alfie Hewitt over fellow Brit Gordon Reid in the quarterfinals of the men's wheelchair singles.
Mike, thank you very much.
This is our BBC. It can take us anywhere.
I hear we're going down the beach.
Raise questions.
So let's try and join all the dots.
Bring us down to Earth.
Floating in a spacesuit.
We can share it with others.
Children need are going to help so many people with that money.
Or keep it to ourselves.
Mr. Shelby will always be alone.
Join millions of people.
Live at the Royal Albert Hall, where we are.
Building our future.
The BBC has put £5 billion into the economy.
There's a BBC for each of us, funded by all of us.
Much to discover.
This is our BBC.
The time is 28 minutes to 7. You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Amal Rajan and Emma Barnett. And now a summary of the news from Jane Steele.
Sir Keir Starmer has told Xi Jinping he wants to build a more sophisticated relationship between the UK and China during their meeting in Beijing. President Xi said greater dialogue was imperative. The Prime Minister's three-day visit is aimed at resetting bilateral ties with a focus on trade, national security and green energy. A leading backer of legislation to allow assisted dying in England and Wales has told the BBC it is very, very difficult to see how the bill can become law this year. The Labour peer, Lord Falconer, is threatening to use powers under the Parliament Act to override peers' objections if the bill isn't passed before the King's speech. Scientists from the UK and South Korea have begun a major research mission on one of Antarctica's most unstable glaciers. Over the next 2 weeks, they will use hot water to drill a kilometre through the Thwaites Glacier, measuring how fast the ice is melting. The team say the data will help them estimate how quickly global sea levels could rise. The government is to instruct schools in England not to automatically send pupils home when they're suspended. The Education Secretary, Bridget Phillipson, said being sent home could mean children retreating to social media and that on-site suspensions should be used instead for pupils who hadn't been violent. A major review of the state of the environment in Wales has found the country is one of the most nature-depleted places in the world. Natural Resources Wales says almost one in five species is at risk of extinction, and poor air quality contributes to up to 1,400 premature deaths a year. The Society of Motor Manufacturers and Traders says the sector suffered its toughest year in a generation last year after the production of cars, vans, trucks and buses in the UK fell to its lowest level since 1952. Just under 765,000 vehicles were built in 2025, a 15% drop on the previous year.
Jane, thank you very much indeed. It is 25 minutes to seven. Let's turn to that assisted dying story. It was meant to be the great social reform of this government, but it's not happening. Henry Zeffman is our chief political correspondent. Henry, what's happened?
Well, this bill passed through the House of Commons in June 2025, and I think a lot of people would have assumed that it was on an inexorable path to becoming law. But it has been bogged down in the House of Lords since then, and there is a clear deadline. It does need to clear the House of Lords by May, which is when the next parliamentary session begins. Otherwise, it falls. And Lord Falconer, the former Labour Justice Secretary, who's been leading the charge in the House of Lords, has been speaking to our colleague Harry Farley, and he said it's very, very difficult. It's not impossible if the Lords were to change the way that they were dealing with it, but very, very difficult to see how this is going to pass. That is a big admission. It's not quite an admission of defeat, but I think it is pretty close to it. And of course, while Lord Falconer would blame the way that opponents of this legislation are approaching the issue in the House of Lords, those opponents would say, well, the bill is defective. They are giving it the scrutiny that they don't believe it got in the House of Commons, and they believe they are preventing a bad bill from becoming law.
Well, Lord Falconer will be on this programme at 8:30. I mean, what's the mechanism by which it's being slowed down until that May deadline? And if the likes of Falconer want to get it through, what do they need to do to overcome those obstacles?
Well, there's an awful lot of amendments being proposed to address concerns raised, not just by members of the House of Lords, but also by various royal colleges. And Lord Falconer and supporters of the bill have proposed various amendments, which they say address at least some of those concerns. But there are just, I think, fundamental differences on how a system of assisted dying could and should be implemented. Lying, by the way, in the back of Lord Falconer's comments is quite an interesting suggestion, which is that he says if the House of Lords doesn't pass this, then the House of Commons could pass it again in the next session, i.e. after May, and they would be willing to seek to invoke the Parliament Act. Now, the Parliament Act, very rarely used, introduced more than 100 years ago to get Lloyd George's controversial budget through the House of Lords. And that is where the House of Commons essentially ignores the House of Lords. It was used most recently to ban fox hunting in 2004. There's a lot of people in government I've been speaking to who are saying that though this is a private member's bill, though this has been a backbencher-led initiative in both houses of Parliament, if it's going to come to that sort of constitutional clash, Keir Starmer might have to step in.
Henry Zeffman, always good to talk to you. Thank you.
It's 23 minutes to seven. He was an orthopaedic surgeon parents trusted with their children, and yet he abused that trust and some of those children by causing severe harm on the operating table. Today, Great Ormond Street Hospital is due to release a report into the actions of Yasser Jabbar. Hugh Pym is our health editor. Some of our listeners may have read about this case, but what do we expect from this report, and have we got a sense of how widespread the harm was?
Well, we have built up an understanding of how widespread the harm was once it became clear that Great Ormond Street, one of the best-known children's hospitals in the world, was carrying out this review into nearly 790 cases of children treated by Yasser Jabbar at the hospital. He was there from 2017 to 2023 as an orthopaedic surgeon, though he stopped operating shortly before the end of that period. He's since surrendered his licence to practice in the UK and is believed to be in Dubai. Now, in those 790 cases, it has emerged that some patients, young patients, came to harm, some severe. This involved lower limb damage because of operations carried out by Yasser Jabbar involving leg straightening and strengthening, resulting in some cases in permanent deformities and even leading to amputation, and a conclusion that these operations in many cases were unnecessary. Now, the Royal College of Surgeons carried out a report for the Trust in 2023 saying that he was using incorrect techniques and unsuitable surgery, and there was a toxic working culture. The Trust having commissioned that report. The families of the patients have said that consistently there were warnings and that he should have been stopped. There were warnings that he was not carrying out the right procedures from colleagues, but no action was taken. And Hudgels, the solicitors representing some of the families, say there needs to be a fully transparent account in this report published today as to what went wrong and how things went wrong for so long, and those responsible must be held accountable.
And speaking of responses, the response from the hospital?
Yes, Great Ormond Street have said, "We are profoundly sorry to all the patients and their families who have been affected by the care provided by Yasser Jabbar at the hospital. The final report summarising our findings of the patient recall process will be made available to the public later today."
Hugh Pym, thank you very much.
It's 20 to 7.
Now, to think about school suspensions and the fact that usually if you are suspended, you're automatically sent home, pupils will not be under new government plans. Instead, more of them will be kept in school learning under supervision to stop them spending those suspension days potentially glued to their phones and social media. The only issue is, I suppose, Hazel Shearing, who's with us now, learning and identity correspondent for the BBC, there are a lot more suspensions, aren't there, as well?
That's exactly right. So in order to understand the context and the main drive for the government's announcement here, which is a trail of the white paper, the delayed schools white paper, which will set out broader changes to the school system in England, including the SEND system. To understand that context, we need to look back to COVID. So cast your minds back. Since COVID, we have seen more pupils missing school, and we've seen attendance initiatives to get them back into school so that they're not missing out on learning. But at the same time, as you point out, we've seen more suspensions, so pupils being told that they can't be in school. And those two things seem at odds with one another, and that's what the government is looking at here, really. It says that pupils who are sent home when they're suspended are already at risk of being disengaged from school and could become further disengaged from school. And of course, when mum and dad, and we've seen a rise, don't forget, in the number of suspensions in primary schools as well, when mum and dad are out at work, a child's at home, are they scrolling on their phones? Are they on social media? So there's a screen time element to all of this as well.
And how will this work? Do we know? And when will this come in?
We don't know exactly yet. And it is one of those things, as I said, it's coming in the white paper, and we will have to wait to set out the details, which is frustrating for us, but also frustrating for head teachers, of course. And head teachers like the idea of a consistent approach across schools, but they are concerned about how these stats are going to be recorded and also how internal suspensions are going to be resourced as well, because there's been no additional funding announced with this. So many schools already do internal suspensions, but what that can look like can really, really vary. I spoke to Coram Children's Legal Centre yesterday, who spoke about one instance where a child had been informally suspended internally, which meant that that child had been out of classrooms for months at a time, but it hadn't been sort of formally a formal suspension. So, as I say, head teachers value consistency, but some will already be doing what the government wants, and some will be told that they need to do more, I suppose, and ultimately it's still up to head teachers what a suspension looks like. So some schools will need to be putting more resources in. The government says it's consulting on a framework, and it will speak to head teachers about their plans. As I say, it's one of those where we will have to wait for the white paper to find out more details.
Indeed. Well, that is what we think at the moment. Hazel Shearing, thank you.
So Keir Starmer missed this week's Prime Minister's questions as he headed to China, hoping to thaw diplomatic relations. But there was still a chill in the Commons, as our parliamentary correspondent Sean Curran now reports.
There's a familiar pattern to Wednesdays at Westminster. Just before noon, MPs start to arrive in the Commons chamber. And before long, the green benches are full. But some well-known faces were missing yesterday.
We don't come to questions to the Deputy Prime Minister.
Sir Keir Starmer's absence meant other party leaders stayed away. The Conservative Shadow Business Secretary Andrew Griffith stood in for Kemi Badenoch, and he'd come equipped with some scripted digs at the Deputy Prime Minister, David Lammy.
You can feel the Deputy Prime Minister's frustration. The Prime Minister's away. The business sector is away. And here he is, left behind Lammy, the designated survivor, having to defend the indefensible.
And he was keen to talk about tensions in the Labour ranks.
This government is blocking people who just want to get on in life. People, Mr. Speaker, ambitious people like Andy from Manchester, having his dreams crushed by Labour.
But David Lammy was just as enthusiastic about poking at a Conservative bruise.
26 Tory MPs and counting have already defected to Reform, and now they're all counting down, Mr. Speaker, because today is 100 days until the Tory transfer window slams shut. It's going to be the longest and most disloyal transfer saga since Sol Campbell left Spurs. And the member for Clacton, I don't know where he is, has signed three white wingers in the past fortnight.
Andrew Griffith sought to brush that off.
I don't know what's in his head, Mr. Speaker. It's our party that is getting stronger. And overnight...
Labour MPs burst out laughing. Some shouted more. And the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, who was sitting next to David Lammy, clapped her hands. As the noise died down a bit, Andrew Griffith resumed his attack.
Won't the Deputy Prime Minister admit what the members behind him are thinking? That it's not the Prime Minister going to China that's the problem, it's the fear that he might come back.
Yeah. Deputy Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, he's not going to get this gig again, is he? Let's face it.
And David Lammy hadn't finished.
This was the week when the leader of the opposition told Desert Island Disc that Britain needs to learn to queue again. And Tory MPs have taken her quite literally. They're lining up outside the member for Clacton's office while they squabble about the damage that they did to our country.
The MP for Clacton is, of course, Nigel Farage. Sitting next to her new Reform colleagues, the former Conservative Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, laughed at that joke about queuing. The Deputy Leader of the Lib Dems, Daisy Cooper, was unimpressed by the Prime Minister's trip to Beijing.
Whilst the Chinese regime continues to hunt down pro-democracy protesters on the streets of Britain with bounties on their heads, the British Prime Minister has gone cap in hand to China to ask for a trade deal on the promise of a super embassy from which the Chinese regime will continue to spy on us.
The Deputy Prime Minister said it would be a dereliction of duty to ignore China.
We'll cooperate where we can, and I'm sure in areas like climate, she would expect us to cooperate, and we will challenge in areas where we disagree. That's the way that we deliver for the public of this country.
Just like the Conservative spokesman, Lee Anderson of Reform UK, had come prepared with a joke.
It was reported on the TV yesterday that the Labour backbenchers are revolting. Yeah, now, that is a matter of opinion.
You don't have a TV license.
Unlike the Labour backbenchers and the Prime Minister.
You don't have a TV license, please.
Those heckles were prompted by Lee Anderson's recent revelation that he doesn't have a television licence. It turned out that he wanted to invite David Lammy to his constituency so that he could speak to pub landlords. The Deputy Prime Minister said he'd once campaigned with Mr. Anderson when he was a Labour councillor.
It's been said of him that when he left, he enhanced the IQ of the Labour Party and the IQ of the party that he went to.
Sounds like that pub crawl is on hold.
It's 12 minutes to 7. That was Sean Curran reporting on yesterday in Parliament.
Well, to a different parliament. The hotly contested Senate elections are coming on May 7th, and they could cause a political earthquake because Labour could lose power in Wales, which would be seismic, as it's been the biggest party in the country at every UK parliamentary election since 1922 and the largest in the Senate at every election since 1999. Hoping to win its first ever seat is the Green Party. The Senate is the only parliament in the UK where the Greens have never been represented. I think that's right. Anthony Slaughter, leader of the Welsh Greens, trying to change that. Good morning.
Good morning, Emma. Yes, that is right. This will be a breakthrough for the Greens in Wales, our first elected members.
Yes, if you manage to do it. What are you offering the people of Wales that might net you your first seat?
I think, firstly, the polls are showing that that if is increasingly likely. I mean, we've been working on the assumption for at least a year that we would get one person, and the polls have only gone in one direction, with the latest on last week showing 11 members. I'm not taking any of that for granted. What it does indicate to me is that there is strong support out there. It reflects what we're hearing on the ground. And I'm very, very confident there will be a group, a significant number of Green Senate members. And what they will bring is, however the next government is formed, and that's all up in the air at the moment, how the numbers will land, we will have an influence on the next Welsh government. And we will be pushing them to be bolder and braver to take, you know, simply changing the management after 26 years of Labour stagnation isn't enough. We need bold, brave government in Wales, and that's what we will be pushing, getting people's bills cut, freezing rents and tackling the nature and climate crisis.
One of your plans includes a new wealth tax of 1% a year on assets of over £10 million, rising to 2% on assets worth more than a billion. You propose replacing a council tax with a wealth tax on property owners. How are you going to do that, and how much would it raise?
I'm glad you referred to the council tax, because obviously wealth tax is an overarching Green Party policy. That isn't a devolved issue. That's yes. For Westminster. But it does set the mood music of the feel in the country these days that people want wealth taxed fairly. And the council tax system in Wales, like elsewhere, is broken. It is unfair and not working. So we're looking at a series of announcements over the next couple of weeks in the run-up to our manifesto launch. And yes, reform replacing council tax will be one of those. We're doing the work on that now. And we will be presenting that to the public in the next couple of weeks. But it really chimes. I've sat on panels with government ministers, Welsh government ministers, who've admitted that tinkering with council tax is trying to fix something that was never fit for purpose anyway. So we think that is going to really resonate. But we will be presenting the full workings and our proposal in the next couple of weeks leading up to the manifesto launch.
But you can't, I mean, in terms of the approval for that, you think that will actually ring true with the powers that be, because you're obviously looking at only getting a seat, and how deliverable, I suppose, is that? What are you saying to the people about that?
Well, again, what I'd say is there is going to be a number of Green Senate members, and that's not me saying that now, that's Welsh commentators, that's the NGOs. There's a level of excitement around the fact there'll be a group of us there. We don't know what the numbers are going to be. Plaid Cymru have indicated that their preference would be to form a minority government. They will still be reliant on the votes of other progressive parties, such as the Greens. So however those negotiations play out, we will have a significant say. And we will be pushing. The fact that we're pushing these bold policies in the election will lead the Welsh electorate, the Welsh public, to expect bolder policies from the future government.
For instance, the principle on council tax reform, you know, big property owners pay more. Is that a way of defining that, and are you do you have that concern, which you will have looked at, I'm sure, that the risk that they leave?
I think that's always a threat. And when we talk about the wealth tax more in general, that's what's always pushed back, is the rich people will just leave. Well, people have got, you know, homes are more than just financial assets. Homes where people live, they've got their life space there, their children are there. It's some people may leave, but we've also got to look at just, you know, how property is used. It ties in with the use of holiday lets, the reforming the law back on that in 2023. And looking at sort of higher council tax for unused homes, we've got a crisis. We've got so many people who can't afford to live in their own communities in Wales. We have to tackle that.
Would you bring back the 20 mile per hour speed limits? Do you think that was it was wrong to row back on that?
I don't think there's been too much row back. I was someone who campaigned at a national level for that and was very deeply involved in the campaign. I think it was the right policy. I was very
so where it has been rowed back. Would you reverse that?
Well, it's always been the case that local authorities have the right to decide. That's been blurred over in all the noise sometimes. And what happened in the local authority where I live, the Vale of Glamorgan, they reviewed it and they actually brought back more 20-mile-per-hour zones. People wanted them. And we're at a stage now, the noise has died down. A small group of people made a lot of noise. We've had the scheme in place for a year now, and significant injuries and deaths have gone down. And when you explain that to communities, they want that. They want their children to feel safer. They want their parents to feel safe. So yes, we would be where Greens are in control of local authorities, which could happen next year in our next round of local authority elections, we would be pushing for wider 20-mile-per-hour rollout, yes.
Anthony Slaughter, leader of the Welsh Greens. And I should say, on yesterday's programme, we spoke to the leader of Plaid Cymru and the Labour Welsh First Minister. We've approached all the Welsh political parties in our look ahead to the Senate elections, and we'll be speaking to the Conservatives after 8.30.
It's 7 minutes to seven. Will driverless taxis be operating on the streets of London by this September? Waymo, the firm owned by Google, reckons that's realistic. Passengers will be able to hail them by using an app. The government says it intends to change regulations so as to allow these so-called robo-taxis to operate. Last night, Zoe Kleinman, our technology editor, asked Amanda Ventura from the public affairs team at Waymo how the driverless vehicles might go down if they're introduced in our capital.
Do you think you're going to be welcomed by the black taxi drivers?
I'm probably not the best person to ask about that, but I do think that, you know, when Waymo is coming to a new city, we are looking at how we can integrate into existing mobility options. So we're hoping to be one more option for people who can't drive, who don't feel comfortable getting into a car with a stranger. There are so many benefits from a psychological and physical safety perspective that we think this technology can bring to people in London.
Well, that, Zoe joins us now. Zoe, that was one of the longest pauses I've heard on the Today programme for a long time. What was, I think it's what we call a pregnant pause. What was going on there? Essentially, black taxi drivers are not going to be too happy, and they might protest in a way that they did when Uber came along as well.
So we know that driverless cars, robo-taxis are coming. The government has signalled that it's going to change the rules later in the year to allow them to operate. And all of the taxi firms are gunning for the UK market. We've heard from Uber and Lyft that they are ready to go as soon as the rules change. Last night, Waymo, which is owned by Google, threw this huge party at the Transport Museum in central London, and nestled in between all the vintage old buses was, I guess, another evolution of public transport, it hopes, which is this robo-taxi, the idea that you hail a car via an app, it comes to you, it picks you up, takes you to where you want to go, and there's no human at the wheel, there's nobody in the car apart from you the whole time. It is inevitably going to be disruptive, isn't it?
They're quite well established in America. They've done lots and lots of journeys. The safety record is pretty good for the most part. How will these robo-taxis navigate the winding streets of our slightly higgledy-piggledy capital, which is very, very different to the sort of, you know, structured block-based system of many big American cities?
Yeah, you're right. The big kind of wide American roads do feel like less of a challenge, perhaps, to the sort of really tight streets with everything that's going on. I've had a ride in a couple of driverless cars with a safety driver at the wheel, I have to say, in London, because that's what you have to do. And the last one I was in, there was somebody sort of going down the middle of the road on a pair of crutches, and I was really quite worried. But the car navigated it without any problems. It's packed with sensors, Amal. It's got four different systems in it, this Waymo one, that are constantly gathering data about what's around it. Waymo says it can see 360 degrees and up to 300 metres away, even in the rain. And then in the boot of these robo-taxis is the brains, if you like, which is a great big, really powerful computer processing that data and informing the car of what it should do next and what everything else around it might do next.
And is the idea that because they haven't got any, you know, pesky old humans, they might actually be a bit cheaper too?
Well, you'd think so, wouldn't you? I did ask Waymo what they were planning to charge, and they said they would be competitive but also premium, and they said the pricing would be dynamic, so of course it would go up based on demand. They've partnered with Jaguar, so their cars are all quite nice Jaguars. Lyft and Uber have gone with a Chinese car maker, interestingly. They've partnered with Baidu. So I guess we're going to see a number of different options on the street, and I think that probably the prices, despite, as you say, not having to pay any human drivers who won't need brakes and time off and sick leave and everything else, I suspect they'll probably charge about the same.
Zoe Kleinman, our technology editor, thank you.
Next week, Matthew Syde returns with this.
Sideways on BBC Radio 4. The ideas shaping our lives and how some people see the world differently.
I felt that instant tugging on the heartstrings when I heard the heartbeat of my own child.
In the new series, we challenge the notion that men can't be broody. Question the everyday absurdities we've come to normalise and ask if miracles are compatible with scientific thinking.
We heard you had a brain tumour. Have a seat and we'll pray for you.
Sideways with me, Matthew Syde, starts next Wednesday morning at 9. To listen on your smart speaker, just say, play Radio 4.
2 minutes to seven, here's Sarah with the weather.
Thanks, Amol. We've got a fairly cloudy, cold day ahead, but thankfully a window of slightly drier weather today before the next area of rain moves in from the southwest later on. And that's going to be unwelcome because we've still got lots of flood warnings in force, 76 across parts of England, in fact, particularly towards the south, including a severe flood warning for the River Stour in Dorset. But let's start with today's detail across southeast England, eastern England, the Midlands, North Wales, northwest England, southwest Scotland and Northern Ireland. Across this zone, things are looking mostly dry. We've got some dense fog around this morning, particularly for central and southern England and East Wales as well. The fog will clear away gradually through the morning, and then I think we'll see a few glimpses of blue sky. So a little bit of brightness, but the cloud will tend to build through the day, so turning a little bit grey and feeling rather cool with temperatures just around 6 to 8 degrees. The winds are going to pick up with some rain arriving by this evening and some hill snow as well in the north. For southwest England and for South Wales this morning, it's going to be a picture of some clearer intervals and also a few scattered showers, nothing too heavy through the morning hours. By this afternoon, though, heavier rain will track its way in from the southwest and the winds will pick up too, with temperatures around 8 or 9 degrees. Lastly, today's weather for northeast England, northern and eastern Scotland, a chilly southeasterly breeze bringing a lot of cloud, some rain showers at low levels, further snow over the higher ground in the east of Scotland. Temperatures here are fairly chilly, 4 to 6 Celsius.
Sarah, thank you very much. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Amol Rajan and Emma Barnett.
It's 7 o'clock on Thursday, the 29th of January. The headlines this morning. Sir Keir Starmer has told China's President Xi Jinping he wants a more sophisticated relationship between the two countries. A leading backer of the assisted dying law says it's very difficult to see how it can pass because of opposition in the Lords. And Elon Musk's electric car maker, Tesla, has experienced its first ever annual decline in revenue.
Coming up in the next hour, ahead of the Grammys this weekend, the man who runs the world's biggest music awards tells us about his fears for the industry.
I don't want to experience a world where, you know, the entirety of the catalog that I'm accessing is somehow driven by machines. That's dystopia.
And just in case you were wondering what it might sound like to start your working day on one of the most unstable glaciers in Antarctica. Windy and cold, I think it's safe to say from that bit of audio. We will hear from one of the researchers who's made the daring journey to the so-called Doomsday Glacier live from West Antarctica at 10 to 8. But before that, we can bring you up to date with the headlines because it's the BBC News with Jane Steele.
Sir Keir Starmer has told President Xi Jinping it's vital the UK and China build a more sophisticated relationship after the two leaders met face-to-face in Beijing. President Xi said ties with Britain had gone through twists and turns that didn't serve the interests of either country. The meeting is the most important part of Sir Keir's visit to China, the first by a British Prime Minister since Theresa May in 2018. From Beijing, here's our political editor Chris Mason.
Amid the formality and history of the Great Hall of the People, both leaders articulated a shared desire for a closer relationship. President Xi pointedly praised Labour governments for what he saw as a history of deepening ties between London and Beijing. The Prime Minister, forever aware of needing to justify what his critics see as his jaunts on the global stage, said his desire for the UK to face outwards, as he put it, reflected the reality that events abroad affect so much back home, from security to prices in the supermarket. President Xi talked of a turbulent and fluid world, the clear subtext, China a beacon of stability amid President Trump's whims, outbursts and unpredictability. But the gloss of diplomacy cannot mask the vast differences of instinct and outlook on human rights and espionage, just for starters.
A leading backer of the assisted dying bill has told the BBC it is very, very difficult to see how it can become law in England and Wales this year because of strong resistance in the House of Lords. More than 1,000 amendments were tabled. The Labour peer, Lord Falconer, said he was considering the unprecedented use of powers under the Parliament Act to override the Lords if the bill wasn't passed before the King's speech. He's been speaking to our political correspondent, Harry Farley.
Time is running out for the assisted dying legislation to pass before the end of this parliamentary session, expected in May. The persistence of opposition in the Lords has led its sponsor, Lord Faulkner, to say the legislation now has absolutely no hope of passing without a fundamental change in peers' approach. According to a government source, ministers are suggesting a compromise, such as setting up a royal commission, could provide a way forward if it doesn't pass. But the architects of the bill say they will use arcane powers under the Parliament Act to bring it back. If an identical replica bill passed the Commons a second time, peers would not be able to block it again. Critics say this would mean forcing a flawed bill into law with no ability to change it. A source close to Labour opponents of assisted dying said the threat was the act of a bully who knew they were losing the argument. But Lord Faulkner argues if elected MPs have passed the bill, then peers should not be able to block it.
The Speaker of the Iranian Parliament has said Tehran is open to talks with Washington after President Trump warned time was running out to negotiate a deal on the country's nuclear program. Speaking to the American news channel CNN, Mohammed Bagheer Ghalibaf said such discussions had to be genuine. Mr. Trump has threatened military action and says a massive US armada is moving towards Iran. A team of scientists from the UK and South Korea have set up camp on one of the most inaccessible and unstable glaciers in Antarctica. Over the next 2 weeks, they will use hot water to drill a kilometre through the ice to gather data to help them estimate how quickly seas may rise around the world. Our climate editor Justin Rowlatt, one of the only a handful of journalists to have ever visited Thwaites, has this report.
Thwaites Glacier has been nicknamed the Doomsday Glacier. The size of Britain, it acts as a natural barrier, holding back neighbouring glaciers in West Antarctica. If they all melt, it would raise global sea levels by some 3 metres, enough to cause devastating flooding to low-lying towns and cities across the UK. And satellite observations show Thwaites is melting increasingly rapidly. The scientists from the British Antarctic Survey and the Korea Polar Research Institute plan to lower instruments through the hole in the ice and relay the first real-time measurements of ocean temperatures and currents at the grounding line, the point where the glacier lifts from the seabed to form a floating ice shelf.
The government is to instruct schools in England not to automatically send children home if they are suspended. The Education Secretary, Bridget Phillipson, said pupils should stay on site if they hadn't been violent. Here's our education correspondent, Hazel Shearing.
We've seen more pupils missing school since COVID and heard a lot about attendance initiatives to get them back in. But we've also seen a rise in pupils being sent home for bad behaviour. There were 955,000 suspensions in England in 2023-24, 21% higher than the year before. The Department for Education will say in its Delayed Schools white paper that more suspensions should take place in school so that pupils don't miss out on learning. Many schools already remove children from class and use on-site suspensions. Pepe Diazio, the General Secretary of the Association of School and College Leaders, welcomed the move towards consistency but questioned how these suspensions would be staffed.
The electric car maker Tesla has experienced its first ever annual decline in revenue. It fell 3% last year. Elon Musk's company is to stop production of two models and shift more of its production to humanoid robots. Here's our North America technology correspondent Lily Jamali.
Tesla was once one of the world's most profitable car companies, but now it says profits dropped 61% in the final quarter of 2025 compared with the previous year. The electric vehicle company has struggled to keep up with China's BYD, and boss Elon Musk's foray into U.S. politics last year likely also dragged on the company's fortunes. Tesla plans to end production of its Model S and Model X vehicles as sales of both models have faltered, with the company shifting its focus to AI and robotics. Its California manufacturing plant will aim to produce 1 million Optimus robots a year, and Tesla will invest $2 billion into Musk's artificial intelligence company, XAI.
Democrats in the U.S. Senate have issued a list of demands designed to rein in the actions of federal immigration agents who have shot dead two protesters in Minneapolis this month. The Senate Minority Leader, Chuck Schumer, says they must be attached to a funding bill for the department which runs ICE, which is due to be voted on soon. The agents who shot dead Alex Preti in Minneapolis have been placed on administrative leave. Mr. Schumer spoke to reporters last night.
We want masks off.
Body cameras on. Federal agents must be prohibited from wearing masks. They must be required to use body cameras, and they also always have to carry proper identification. No more anonymous agents, no more secret operatives.
Most water companies in the UK are to put up household bills by more than inflation in April. The industry body Water UK says the average annual bill in England and Wales will go up by £33 to £639. Consumer groups want a stronger safety net to help those struggling to pay. Here's our cost of living correspondent Kevin Peachey.
On average, bills will go up this April by just over 5%. But increases for water and sewerage services range from less than 1% for customers of troubled Thames Water to 10% at Severn Trent, although the total bill there is lower. Bills are going up by 7% at South East Water. It's under investigation after supplies were shut off to thousands of customers this winter. A week ago, an average rise of nearly 9% was announced for Scotland.
The government is being urged to intervene to save Britain's oldest roller coaster from permanent closure. The owners of the Dreamland amusement park in Margate have announced that the Grade 2 listed scenic railway is no longer viable. But the local council wants the culture secretary to intervene, saying it's of international importance.
Indeed. Jane, thank you very much for that. It's 9 minutes past seven now, and it certainly is historic. Sir Keir Starmer has become the first Prime Minister in 8 years to visit China. And this morning, just before we came on air, he had a meeting with China's leader, President Xi, and Prime Minister Li at Beijing's Great Hall of the People. That's its name. The meeting lasts an hour and 20 minutes, we're told, almost double the expected length. The trip is not without its controversies, not least after it was reported China has hacked the phones of senior Downing Street officials during the last government. And the trip was only understood to have gone ahead after the Prime Minister had approved a controversial new Chinese mega-embassy in London. But the government has insisted that this trip will make the UK richer and was necessary to reassert relations with the second most powerful economy in the world. Laura Bicker is our China correspondent who joins us from Beijing. Laura, what more, first of all, can you tell us of this meeting, longer than expected?
Yeah, I think it was almost double the expected time. We've had a readout of what they were discussing. We've seen sectors from education, so that might mean more students going between the two countries, healthcare, finance, artificial intelligence, and clearly one of the subjects that the UK has been interested in is renewable energy. Remember, China really leads the way when it comes to manufacturing solar power, solar panels, renewable kind of technology like wind turbines and electric vehicles. We understand that there are discussions underway and as to whether or not there could be Chinese investments in a car plant in the United Kingdom. So we'll have to watch that in the near future. When we talk about thorny subjects, the issue of Taiwan and Hong Kong did come up, we are told, Taiwan being the self-governing island that China claims as its own and has vowed to retake by force if necessary. We didn't hear exactly what was said, but we understand it did come up. Hong Kong too was mentioned, and we hear that the UK described it as an important bridge between the two countries. But while the UK is keen to emphasise the business between the two sides, it's clear that in President Xi's words, where he talks about the power politics at play, he called for a more just and reasonable global governance system. He talked about the impact that some actors are having on the world order. This isn't for them just about meeting Sir Keir Starmer. This is about more about what it means on the world stage.
Yes, and as people discuss the global order being reordered at the moment, with especially driven by Donald Trump's actions and not necessarily knowing what those will be, it is very pertinent indeed. Have we got a sense of how it's being received in China, not just this meeting, but the trip? I spoke to you yesterday just as ahead of the Prime Minister landing.
So Chinese state media have actually featured it quite prominently, which we weren't expecting. It was his arrival was announced. You know, state media had a reporter on the tarmac as the plane was coming down. There's been some discussion about less about Sir Keir Starmer, but more about kind of Britain as a whole and its history and its Sherlock Holmes and all of these things. And when you talk to people here, especially young people, there's a real interest in what's happening in the United Kingdom. I think they're only hear what they're told. Remember, there's a massive firewall around this country. You can only really access what state media tell you unless you have something called a VPN to jump the firewall and get international internet, but those are illegal. So there is a genuine interest in kind of what's going on, and that's shown in the fact that there are large numbers of Chinese students come to the UK each year, and that might be expected to increase. And I think there's also perhaps hope from tourism businesses here that more British tourists will come if that visa-free travel is offered.
We will keep with this trip and the latest coming out of it and what we can glean from it. Laura Bicker, our China correspondent, joining us there from Beijing. Thank you.
13 minutes past seven, pupils suspended for bad behaviour won't automatically be sent home under new government plans. More of them will be kept in school, basically to stop them spending days glued to their phones. The latest figures suggest that suspensions are particularly high at the moment. In 2023-24, they were 21% higher than the year before. But Bridget Phillipson, the Education Secretary, has said that she's concerned that suspended pupils who are sent home simply retreat to social media. Maybe it's better for them to be suspended, as it were, in school. Steve Chalk, a familiar voice on this programme, is founder of the Oasis Charitable Trust, runs 55 schools with a student population of 32,000 pupils, and has, I suspect, Steve, come across a few suspended pupils in the past. Good morning.
Good morning, Amal. Yeah, I have.
Is this good news for vulnerable pupils, of which you have dealt with many, many, many over the years?
Absolutely. It might be good news. That's what I'd say. First of all, it's to be welcomed, isn't it? Anything that seeks to include children rather than exclude them is to be welcomed. It's a huge step forward. So we've got to applaud it. But we know, and we all know, don't we, that sending a child out of school home, the issue with the phones and other devices and getting hooked into social media is the popular thing of the moment. And it's important we talk about. And it's interesting the government have linked it to that. But of course, there are other dangers. Most kids are going home just to wander the streets because it is socioeconomically underserved communities that are far overrepresented in terms of suspensions. If you look at the figures, it's not the middle classes, it's others that are sent home. So they're going to wander their streets. They're prone to falling into violence, danger, being groomed, becoming mules in gangs. We know that keeping kids in schools really matters, but we've got to get deeper than that, I think, Amal. We've got to get deeper than that because we've got to ask, and we don't have any detail about this yet, what are the resources for schools to do this who are already overstretched? Is this child going to end up sitting in isolation in a box? And that doesn't do any good.
And Steve, what about the other pupils? I mean, if you've got an unruly pupil, and you know you've dealt with, I've had the privilege of seeing you talk to pupils who've got behavioural issues many, many times. Isn't there a case for defending the interests of the other pupils at the school who want to be able to learn in a non-chaotic environment and have quiet? Isn't it in their interest for the pupils who do transgress so badly that they deserve a suspension to be out of the school environment?
Well, I don't think so, actually, Amal.
Right.
But I absolutely agree with you that no child should disrupt the education of another child. What I'm really saying is that what schools need is the resources to give to the child who's being suspended. You know, when you dig into these things, there's always a reason behind it. I talked to some youth workers just at the end of last week, and they begun working in a school without lanyards on, so they weren't part of the staff, so kids could be honest with them. And there were two girls, two sisters, who were playing up who'd been suspended several times, but the school hadn't had time to look at what was going on. When the youth workers learnt their story, their mother had become terminally ill.
And that's why they were playing up.
They've been absolutely broken by this, and you can understand why that was destroying their behaviour. So suspending a child, just the term suspension says you're labelled, you're other, and you become a self-fulfilling prophecy. So what we've really got to dig into, which I know you know all about, is that big word, pedagogy, which people use as interchangeable with curriculum, which is the content of what you learn. But pedagogy is the way we learn. So we've got to get more inclusive, more bespoke, and great. A child shouldn't sit in a classroom disrupting the education of another. But we've got to ask, what does this kind of suspension, let's change the term in my view, but what would this mean? And how do we create the bespoke care for these children that's inclusive that they need in order that we don't keep on suspending them and they don't get end up in criminality?
OK, Steve Chalk, founder of the Oasis Charitable Trust. Good to talk to you. Thank you.
18 minutes past seven. Profits at Lloyds Banking Group, the UK's biggest mortgage lender, saw profits rise in 2025. Felicity Hannah has more on that. Morning, Fliss.
Morning. Yes. So this is the bank's full year results, and profit before tax was £6.7 billion, up 12% on the year before. So let's talk to Charlie Nunn, Group CEO at Lloyds Banking Group. Charlie, good morning. What's behind the increase?
Morning, Felicity. Yes, we had a strong result in 2025. Good news is customers are trusting us with more of their banking and financial services. So lending up 5% or £22 billion, £17 billion of first-time buyer mortgages lent, £14 billion increase in savings, 3.5 million new savings accounts. We've now done £100 billion of infrastructure investment for the UK. So growth in the underlying business, and we had good investment in innovation and new services coming to customers as well.
OK, well, you're the biggest mortgage lender in the UK. So you've talked about growth there, but what are you seeing in terms of your customers' confidence, how they're feeling about what they're borrowing?
Yeah, well, overall household confidence, as you know, took a hit in the second half of last year. But actually underlying the strength of households, we saw another strong year of growth in financial resilience for the majority of households. Some households are struggling to make ends meet, but overall confidence is increased and savings and financial resilience increased for 60% of households. And, you know, the mortgage market reflected that. We saw actually quite strong volumes last year. Good demand. We've seen interest rates come down a bit, and we are expecting two more interest rate cuts this year. So a healthy mortgage market. And obviously, as an industry and as Lloyds Bank, we've been innovating around how we provide affordability and access to mortgages, which has supported that growth.
What's your outlook then for house prices this year with those potential cuts coming down the road?
Yes, so last year in 2025, house prices only increased about 0.3 to 0.5%, so a slower a year. We do think house prices will be increased slightly more this year, so we're projecting about 2% growth in house prices. So a stable but positive year, and that's being supported, as we say, by good demand and these slightly lowering rates.
OK, well, you lend to people, to consumers, but also to businesses. So you talked about consumers' savings levels being up, but looking at your results, businesses' savings seem to be falling a bit. Now, we've heard a lot of anxiety about business rates recently as well. What are you seeing in terms of business confidence?
Yes, yeah, so the business world is a bit more complex. I know you've talked a lot about this. Some sectors are obviously having a more challenging time, especially hospitality and retail. When you look at businesses overall, their financial resilience has increased last year. And actually, our working capital accounts and current accounts actually increased for businesses last year, which is really important. We also saw confidence 10 points higher in our business survey at the end of last year after we had the budget than we saw at the start of last year. So they do have the capacity to invest and they have got rising confidence. But at this stage, we're not seeing the investment that we'd hope with the SME sector. And we're really committed to trying to make that make a difference. Actually, this year, we've committed £35 billion of new lending to businesses in the UK.
And how confident are you feeling? Because we've had two tax raising budgets. There was a lot of speculation each time there might be a new windfall tax on banks. Didn't happen. But when you look at your profits, are you still braced for something that might come in the future?
Well, we've forecast this year what we would call a very resilient but slower growth economy, about 1.2% GDP growth, with unemployment peaking in the second quarter and rates coming down a bit. We do think, though, that there is a potential to move to a higher growth trajectory. We have a whole set of reforms landing from the government, whether it's around planning, house spending and support for the economy, infrastructure spending. And this is the year that large organisations like Lloyds need to provide support and confidence to households and businesses to break out to that higher growth trajectory.
Charlie Nunn, Group CEO at Lloyds Banking Group. Thank you.
And Fliss, thank you very much indeed. The time now is 22 minutes past seven.
And we're going to be having a look at screens, I think, our own screens. And here on the programme, we've been speaking a lot about the potential social media ban for under 16s, the rights and the wrongs of putting that into law, as well as the role of phones in schools. On Friday's programme, tomorrow that is, we're going to be looking in more detail at how this plays out in the home. We've been asking for you to get in touch. You've not been disappointing, but we're disappointing us. Of course you haven't. But how parents handle their family's use of social media and screen time more generally. How are you approaching this? How are you approaching this with yourself?
Yeah, we mentioned this on yesterday's programme. Lots and lots of you got in touch. Thank you so much for all the messages. Listener Harriet emailed in to say the following. I am a parent who has spent 3 hours this morning while my child was still sleeping trying to fix the parental controls on his phone. He is 13. Since he was 11, he has found every single way around the phone controls. Ask any parent, they don't work. They are Byzantine, complex, completely counterintuitive. They ask for passwords that you don't know repeatedly. Things you've blocked in the controls continue to work. Some apps seem completely impossible to block. I've tried paid apps. I've used control apps. They do not work. It is poisoning the relationship with my child. There should be a law that phone companies take responsibility when they sell a phone, that they ask, is it for a child, and then help us to set up the controls. We are asking children to self-regulate, as if they can self-regulate a highly addictive device full of highly addictive apps. Thank you so much for that, Harriet.
Another listener, Jack, has got in touch there with a very different view. He sent us this message. I have two teenage boys who have grown up with screens and technology. They are now more attached than ever to their phones as they use them to communicate with friends and family for entertainment and schoolwork. I think the argument around screen time is disproportionate and over the top. My children do not access harmful content, nor have I ever seen it on their social media use, which as a parent, I check. iPhones also have a very effective screen time and parental set of controls, which, although they can result in teenage boys moaning at me, work. Parents need to learn how to use the technology better. We parents screen time with rules, discussion about time, and by spending time with our boys, no phones at mealtimes, sports, and encouraging outdoor activity. We've not had a problem, and both my sons are doing well at school. Jack, thank you for that.
Yeah, I mean, the feeling amongst our listeners, amongst you, is so strong about this whole issue of screen times and social media and young people that we're going to dedicate a lot of tomorrow's programme to it, particularly towards the end of tomorrow's programme. And we really do still want to hear from you. So what are the conversations that you have with your children or grandchildren? What limits or rules do you set around social media, screens and phones? What about your own behaviour and the example you tried to set? I was very struck last week when I spoke to some wonderful 12-year-olds in Sunderland that when they looked at their screen time, it was a lot lower than my screen time, which was a mildly embarrassing revelation. Send us a message or voice note on WhatsApp. The number is 0330 123 4346. That's 0330 123 4346. Or you can email us on today@bbc.co.uk.
And if you are struggling with your own screen time and modelling and setting better examples, which Amal, maybe we both are, my friend told me yesterday, if you say before you pick up your phone what you're going to do on it, if you say it out loud, you then won't get distracted as easily by going to scroll or do something else. So set it an intention out loud. I've not tried it yet. It'd be quite strange if I did that this morning, certainly anywhere near a microphone. But there you go. One bit of news you can use, perhaps. You can try it and let us know. We're going to hear from experts and parents on the programme tomorrow morning, as Amal was saying, to share some advice and their experiences.
Intentional living, right? We intend to spend the next few minutes listening to Mike Williams talking about the sport. Tell us, Mike.
Thank you, Amal. Yes, well, quite the night, wasn't it, in the Champions League? 36 teams, 18 simultaneous matches, 61 goals scored. And at the end of it all, a final league table which sees 5 of the 6 English clubs automatically qualify for the last 16. Let's try and make sense of it all with correspondent John Murray, who joins us live from Paris this morning. Hi, John.
Yes, morning, Mike.
So let's start then with the English sides. 5 of the 6, as we say, securing a top 8 finish that brings direct progression to the last 16. The team to miss out, Newcastle, who you were watching in Paris.
Yes, I think overall, really, a resounding success for the English clubs, which reflects the power of the Premier League. And 3 of them in the top 4. Arsenal, top of the table, won 8 out of 8. Liverpool 3rd, Tottenham fourth. I think Chelsea and Manchester City, of them, had the best nights of the Premier League clubs. Liam Rossini's best day yet as Chelsea's manager, I would call it. They won 3-2 in Italy, which sent them through and knocked out the Italian champions, Antonio Conte's Napoli, out of the competition altogether. And Manchester City as well, they had to win. They did against Galatasaray. They needed other results to go their way, so that jumped them into the top eight. And yes, here in Paris, Newcastle missed out on the top eight, despite what was actually a very creditable 1-1 draw against the holders, PSG, which means they'll also have to play in the extra playoff round next month.
All right, so that's the English clubs. There was, though, John, drama all over Europe last night. We have to mention what happened in Portugal. Not sure how many goals scored by goalkeepers you've commentated on in your career, but that's what we saw last night. Benfica beating Real Madrid 4-2, thanks to their goalkeeper, Anatoly Trubin, up for a free kick in the 98th minute, scoring with a header to secure Jose Mourinho's side a place in the playoffs on goal difference. Before we get your thoughts on that, John, this is your Portuguese counterpart describing the drama last night on radio in Lisbon.
Benfica 3, Real Madrid 2. O árbitro David Massa vai apitar. Alves se vai bater o livre. Ele vai, ele vai, ele vai, ele vai. Levantou na área, cabeceamento, gol!
They can't believe it. There's a moment in there where he says, "This is why football is amazing." John, you just can't describe it, can you?
No, he'll be gargling this morning, won't he, after that? Yeah, that was the moment of the night, really. A bit of old-style Jose Mourinho magic. And the result of that means that while they squeaked into the top 24, it meant that the record winners, Real Madrid, finished outside the top eight, his former club. I think he'll have enjoyed that as well. And I must as well, Mike, give an honourable mention for Bodø Glimt, the little Norwegian team we were talking about last week. Absolutely defied the odds to win remarkably away against Atletico Madrid, having beaten Manchester City in the Arctic Circle last week. So Bodø Glimt are into the playoff round as well.
Yeah, brilliant result for the Norwegians. Just briefly then, John, what happens now? Draw for the knockout rounds tomorrow, isn't it?
Yeah, the draw that will map out the route to the final in Budapest will take place tomorrow morning. We know already that Newcastle will play either Monaco or Karabag next month, and potentially Barcelona or Chelsea for Newcastle in the round of 16. It's possible Manchester City could end up playing Real Madrid in the round of 16. And I would say the draw looks quite favourable for Liverpool, Tottenham and Arsenal. So the latter stages could be packed with English clubs this season.
Wait that draw with interest. John Murray, safe journey home, live from Paris. Many thanks.
I wish, Mike, that we could make those sorts of noises sometimes on the radio. Can you imagine? Just to release, it'd be great. Anyway, talking of release, Mike, thanks for that. Get ready for some boardroom bust-ups.
The hunt for Lord Sugar's new business partner is on.
The next 12 weeks will be the toughest of your life.
And this year's candidates are going to bring in the money.
We can go in at 10K.
For $10,000, we'd expect a private jet to the pyramids.
What?
Going to take on the world.
We're running about Hong Kong and it's absolutely chaotic.
Going to face the music.
One of the worst performances in the history of this process. You're fired.
The Apprentice starts tonight on BBC iPlayer.
A quick look at the weather. It will be largely cloudy and misty to start, but it should remain dry with the odd isolated shower, with breezes expected throughout.
And coming up after the news on the programme, as Iran's foreign minister warns his country's armed forces are ready with their fingers on the trigger, we will ask what happens when Trump's so-called massive armada arrives in the region.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Amol Rajan. It is 29 minutes to 8. Here's a summary of the news from Jane Steele.
Sir Keir Starmer has told Xi Jinping it is vital the UK and China build a more sophisticated relationship after the two leaders met face-to-face in Beijing. The Prime Minister said they had productive discussions on areas of cooperation which would benefit people in the UK. The account of the meeting issued by the Chinese government dismissed suggestions that Beijing posed a security threat and said the two leaders discussed working together across sectors including education, finance and new energy. A leading backer of legislation to allow assisted dying in England and Wales has told the BBC it is very, very difficult to see how the bill could become law this year. The Labour peer, Lord Faulkner, is threatening to use powers under the Parliament Act to override peers' objections. Scientists from the UK and South Korea have begun a major research mission on one of Antarctica's most unstable glaciers after satellite images showed it is melting increasingly rapidly. They will drill a kilometre through Thwaites Glacier, measuring how fast the ice is melting. The government is to instruct schools in England not to automatically send pupils home when they are suspended. The Education Secretary, Bridget Phillipson, said being sent home could mean children retreating to social media and that on-site suspensions should instead be used for pupils who hadn't been violent. Democrats in the US Senate have issued a list of demands designed to rein in the actions of federal immigration agents who've shot dead two protesters in Minneapolis this month. The Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says they must be attached to a funding bill for the department which runs ICE, which is due to be voted on soon. Elon Musk's Tesla has reported its first ever annual drop in revenue. It also said its profits dropped by 61% in the last quarter of 2025. The firm has been overtaken by China's BYD as the world's biggest seller of electric vehicles.
Jane. Thank you. At 27 minutes to eight, let's turn our attention then to Iran, because President Trump has told the country to come quickly to the table and negotiate a nuclear deal, repeating that a US armada was heading to the country. If it fails to do so, he's warned his next attack on the regime will be far worse than the strikes on Iran last June. The US has deployed 10 warships to the region in readiness for a potential attack. Iran's mission to the UN has responded by saying Tehran is ready for dialogue, but that if pushed, it will defend itself and respond like never before. Kirsten Fontenrose is a former senior director for the Gulf at the US National Security Council in the first Trump administration. She's now at the Atlantic Council, which is a non-partisan think tank focusing on international affairs. I asked Kirsten what her read was on Donald Trump's endgame and how seriously she thinks these threats around Iran should be taken.
President Trump's preference is certainly still for a deal, not only a nuclear deal, but the deal would also have to incorporate the missions programs, the drone programs, the proxy militia funding and arming programs. The U.S. still stands by that as the demands that are on the table. And he's hoping that a deal can be made. The strike would be a last desired resort, but it's not, definitely not off the table.
And what does that mean? I mean, in terms of time and how long, because, you know, there's many who thought he would do something earlier.
There are, and there are those who say he's already lost the window, and there are those who say the window hasn't quite opened. So if you're him, you're hearing from one half of your staff, please don't go starting a forever war. Please don't give us a nation building program. We'd rather have our funds come home and address domestic problems. He's got another side saying, look at your legacy. This is the weakest the Iranian regime has been since the revolution. The people are clamoring for our support, so we have popular coverage to go in and eliminate what we've considered a threat as well. So he has two different sides of his senior advisory committee leading him to what would be two very different decision points. So I think that the timeline is really his own.
It's very interesting. I mean, how much will the midterms play a feature in that as well? Because he's got to keep the base happy and he's got to look home. And there have been on his watch a lot of moments where internationally, even if he's thinking of America first, he's had to do something.
There are two schools of thought of that. It's a really interesting question, because on the one hand, if he did strike and it did overthrow a really reviled regime, it would make him quite popular. He could claim a big foreign policy victory. On the other hand, the majority of his base is not concerned about Iran, and they would rather not see America embroiled in something sticky overseas. You also have the potential for Iranian-American voters who were central to his presidential election deciding where they're going to fall this particular time. Many of them are saying, we really thought you were going to follow through when you said you were going to send help and you haven't. So does that mean that you emboldened people to come to the street who were then killed by the regime? Where does that leave them in their support for Trump, and how would that impact the midterm? So there are a lot of factors at play.
Yeah, and I think to pick up on that, you know, we heard on our program yesterday from people inside Iran who are very disappointed with President Trump for appearing to support the protesters and then not following through on his threats. What do you say to that, or what do you make of that? Because the idea that a deal could benefit people in Iran who need and want, and thousands of whom have died for regime change.
Absolutely. And that's completely legitimate. They did read his words to mean that some kind of help was coming, although it wasn't really stated what that help would be. And certainly one of the things that we talk about here in Washington is that when the Iranian community comes to D.C. and asks for help, there is not a united voice in that either. There is question here about who would even pick up the trash in Iran the day after an American strike if that were to happen. So the U.S. does not want to take on another country's set of problems fully the day after. We don't want to do something that will inspire some sort of civil war or create factional tension or revive longstanding ethnic tensions inside Iran. And when different parties come to Washington with different messages, what it tells any U.S. administration is there is not enough consensus on the ground for us to feel like there will be something stable in place if we do take action. That really makes policymakers think twice.
That was Kirsten Fontenrose, former senior director for the Gulf at the US National Security Council in the first Trump administration. Well, listening to that is our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette. Lise, good morning. Thanks for being with us. What is your response to what you've just heard, that analysis, and what can you tell us from Iran?
Anyone listening to that and hearing completely different scenarios with a whole array of consequences would think, well, my goodness, you know, there are no good options. And we keep going back to what President Trump says. He says, I like to win, and I want to win the end game in Iran. And perhaps even President Trump himself doesn't know what the end game is. Is it just to try to do a Venezuela, which is to try to take out the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei? That will be much more difficult. We keep hearing taunts from the Israeli Mossad agency saying to the protesters, largely saying, we're with you, we're walking with you. We do know that Mossad is operating on the ground. We saw it spectacularly last June when Israel was able to take out in one night 9 nuclear scientists and a few heads of the top security agencies. Is President Trump, and then what would happen? He's looking back at history. He keeps talking about the chaos in Iraq, where the Ba'athist party was, the army was stood down because they were seen as a element of the old Ba'athist regime. He keeps talking about how they took up Qasem Soleimani, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard chief, and Abu Bakr Baghdadi, the head of Islamic State. He wants short, sharp, successful. And especially now, and he won't be the first U.S. president to want a diversion from the domestic problems at home. And for President Trump, that is, of course, what's happening, the mess in Minneapolis. It is the rising cost of living. It's his promises to his base. So we see in his social media posts, including yesterday, where he told Iran, time is running out, come to the table. But if you don't, I'm going to hit you like never before. And I will repeat what Kirsten said. He has repeatedly said he wants the deal. And in the same way that he exaggerated the deal he achieved in Gaza, and it was a real breakthrough when he got the first phase of the ceasefire, the first phase of a 20-point peace plan, he hailed it as the biggest peace deal in the Middle East for 3,000 years. He wants to say, I did it. I ended the enmity with Iran, which goes back to the 1979 Iranian Revolution and the taking of American hostages. That's what he wants. His frustration is he's not sure he can get it.
Lise Doucette, our chief international correspondent on the latest on Iran. And of course, we'll keep following that story with any details as we get it.
20 to 8. How do you save the music industry? That is, how do you make sure that artists and creators, you know, the actual musicians, get a fair deal for their work, that they actually get paid? And how do you make sure that in an era where AI artists, that is completely fake, non-human musicians who specialise in verisimilitude, are proving wildly popular on streaming service, we pesky old sapiens still have a chance? Panos A. Panay is the president of the Recording Academy. That's the organisation that's in charge of the Grammys. And it is the 67th Grammy Awards show this Sunday, one of the biggest nights in the music industry's calendar. Panos Panay is our guest on Radical this week, and he's both thoughtful and outspoken about the state of the creative industries and music in particular. We began by talking about AI. I asked him how big a threat artificial intelligence is to music.
It's a massive threat. And look, there's also a big upside. we cannot downplay the threat to the incomes of creators. There could also be a counter incentive by streaming services to necessarily identify AI music, because if you don't have to pay somebody, then great. Is there a world where perhaps functional music will be entirely AI driven? Maybe. But no, I don't want to experience a world where, you know, the entirety of the catalog that I'm accessing is somehow driven by machines. That's dystopia.
What can be done, what is being done to stop this relentless march?
Well, first of all, it's all about the ethical use of other people's creations. So for me, there needs to be both legislation and a broader agreement about ethically develop LLMs or large language models. Then I do think that the downright stealing of identity, stealing of intellectual property, and the creation of content that is purely meant to mislead, there should be some legislation that makes that illegal. You know, I cannot be listening to a song that I think is made by, you name the artist, a Drake, a Bad Bunny, a Rosalia, and think that it's her. Mm. That's not okay. So as an organization, we spend a lot of time educating legislators and on Capitol Hill to advance legislation that fundamentally protects human creators.
That's Panos A. Panay. He's the president of the Recording Academy. They put on the Grammys, which are showing this Sunday. You can find that interview on Radical. Just search for Radical with Amol Rajan on BBC Sounds.
At 17 minutes to 8, though, let's catch up with this moving story in Sakir Starmer's trade trip to China. The Prime Minister has been speaking to the BBC's political editor, Chris Mason, following his one-hour, 20-minute meeting with President Xi Jinping. Here's what he had to say about whether President Xi is someone he can do business with.
We did have a good meeting, and a long meeting as well. We had the formal parts, we had some informal parts, and then we continued over lunch. And so the relationship is in a good place, a strong place. And what I'd say to everybody here is that I always act in our national interest. And therefore the question for me is, how does this accelerate and deliver back at home? I know that whatever's going on in the world, the most important thing to the vast majority of people is the cost of living. So opening up access to business, opportunities, seizing those opportunities, which then gets reflected in better businesses, in jobs, in price reductions at home, really, really matter. And so we made real progress on all of those areas.
There are, though, big differences, significant differences between the UK and China in terms of outlook. How forcefully did you raise issues such as the jailing of the pro-democracy campaigner Jimmy Lai, the treatment of the Uyghurs, for instance?
Well, we raised those issues, as you would expect. Part of the rationale for engagement is to make sure that we can both seize the opportunities that are available, which is what we've done, but also have a mature discussion about issues that we disagree.
Were they listening on that, you think?
Yes, we did have a respectful discussion about that, raised those issues, as you would expect. But that, if you like, is part and parcel of the reason to engage.
Sounds very polite. Chris Mason joins us on the line from China, from the trip. Chris, how far does what the Prime Minister told you about that conversation with Jimmy Lai and his case reflect the tone of the conversation, do you think, between them?
Yeah, morning to you, Emma. It was fairly broad brush answers, I think, from the Prime Minister there in answer to my questions on behalf of all of the broadcasters. It's one of those pool interviews where we take it in turns to ask the questions. I think the key takeaway the Prime Minister is seeking to emphasise is this defrosting, this warming up of relations between London and Beijing. He thinks them dogmatically frozen in recent years, 8 years since a British Prime Minister has visited China. And I was really struck. I asked him on behalf of the other broadcasters, is this a man you feel you can do business with President Xi, and he said yes. And I'm conscious that for some, you know, some might feel squeamish about that. We heard yesterday Kemi Badenoch, the Conservative leader, say explicitly if she were president now, she wouldn't be on this visit. But the Prime Minister making that argument about how he thinks it is pragmatic and in the UK's economic interests. And you heard there, and he's at pains to do this, Emma, over and over again on this trip, to ground what he is doing in the benefits he thinks it can bring home, even referring to supermarket prices in the opening public exchanges of his bilateral conversation with the President in the Great Hall of the People. He's so aware of the criticism he gets for the number of foreign trips that he does that he seeks to constantly pin it back on what he hopes are benefits for people back home.
And that concept of the UK being richer for this trip, I mean, as you say, there's lots of debate whether we'll be richer or poorer morally. But what does that mean? What does he have to do now, do you think, to make good on that?
Well, I think there's two elements to that sort of that sense of richer. I think firstly is the most obvious, which is, you know, here is a government that is desperately in hunt of economic growth, and they look in the direction of an economy like China, a superpower like China, and see a deepening of economic ties as valuable in the pursuit of that end. I think there's also a recognition on this trip of the kind of soft power of British cultural influence amongst the wider delegation. It's not just your kind of blue chip CEOs, it is also leaders of cultural organisations, museums and others from around the UK. And I think that sense of Britain as a cultural export to China, which can be useful, yes, economically, but also in a soft power sense as far as London-Beijing relationships are concerned.
And in terms of, I suppose, what's the mood on this trip, could you say? You're speaking to us from Beijing. You've done a lot of these trips now with leaders. It's quite an astonishing one in many ways.
Yeah, it is. So I'm on a bus, as we heard, through the city centre at the moment. The thing I'm struck by journalistically is quite often when I accompany the Prime Minister on a foreign trip to G7 summits or G20 summits or whatever it might be, quite often the big pressing news story or talking point is not actually connected to the trip that we're on, but the trip provides us with access to the Prime Minister. This trip is different because the trip itself is clearly newsworthy and significant, given the gap there's been since the previous trip, and given that it is a matter of political contention as to whether this kind of engagement with a country like China is wise or not. Now, the Prime Minister has a very clear view on that and seems to be revelling, actually, in what he sees as this outward projection of British confidence in terms of foreign affairs, looking at the world through the three blocks, if you like, of the European Union, China and the United States, and the Prime Minister's view that he wants to deepen the relationship with all three of those, very conscious that the trade-offs in so doing are profound in almost every direction.
Chris Mason, thank you. Hope you get some decent food, perhaps, while you're there. One of the potential perks of being in Beijing, as well as some rest at some point. Chris Mason will keep us up to date with the rest of the team on what's going on with this historic trip to China.
10 to 8, time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is Canon Angela Tilby.
Good morning. Yesterday, in St Paul's Cathedral, the election was confirmed of Sarah Mullally as the 106th Archbishop of Canterbury. This marks a significant moment for the Church of England and for the millions round the world who belong to the Anglican Communion. Among them are some who regret her appointment, who believe, for reasons drawn from the Bible or from church tradition, that women should not hold such authority. Dame Sarah's predecessors as Archbishop of Canterbury date back to the end of the 7th century and include the missionary Bishop Augustine, the scholar Anselm of Bec, and many others who were more or less saintly and learned. Historically, the role has been highly political, and it's come with real dangers. Thomas Becket was murdered in Canterbury Cathedral. Simon Sudbury was beheaded during the Peasants' Revolt. Thomas Cranmer was burnt at the stake as a heretic. William Lord was executed for treason during the English Civil War. There's a charming picture of a young Sarah Mullally at the start of her former career in nursing, in her grey uniform and nurse's cap, looking a bit uncertain. She was born into a world where women's equality could not be taken for granted. I can remember when I worked for the BBC in the 1970s, there was controversy about whether women should read the news because it was thought they might get over-emotional. This was at the same time as some were saying women couldn't be preachers because their voices didn't convey sufficient gravitas. And yet even St. Paul, who was not exactly a feminist by today's standards, insisted in his letter to the Galatians that in Christ Jesus there is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female. In 1992, when the vote went through the General Synod for women to become priests, I was rung up by a former BBC colleague, an agnostic with little interest in the church. For her, women priests was not just church business, but a step forward for all women, a symbolic moment of truth. Yet, even as Sarah Mullally's election is confirmed, there's been news from Afghanistan to the effect that girls are to continue to be denied schooling. They're to live totally restricted lives, barely allowed to inhabit public space. It's a grim reminder that the right of women to a fulfilled life is not to be taken for granted. Sarah Mullally will face many responsibilities as Archbishop, both to the Church and the nation. She said that she hopes to lead with calmness, consistency and compassion. The confirmation of her election is another symbolic moment of truth, and I wish for her all fortitude and grace. I suspect she's going to need it.
That was Thought for the Day with Canon Angela Tilby. The time now is 8:08. Well, it's not often that any programme in the UK can say we go live now to Antarctica, but we're about to go live to Antarctica. And not just any old bit of that icy continent, the freezing underbelly of the world, but not far away from the Thwaites Glacier in West Antarctica. This is a very, very large place, one of the most inaccessible places on Earth, and we all owe it rather a lot, because at about 74,000 square miles, it has ice which is in places 2,000 metres thick. The glacier, the Thwaites Glacier, is melting, but if it were to collapse, which it won't do very soon, global sea levels would rise by 65 centimetres. That's one reason it is nicknamed the Doomsday Glacier. For context, since 1900, global mean sea level has risen by around 23 centimetres. Therefore, it would be quite a good thing if the Thwaites Glacier stayed in place. Getting to the water underneath it, 2,000 metres down, is yet another success story for British science, because this is the first time that scientists have managed to drill underneath the glacier to investigate those waters underneath. Dr. Peter Davis is a physical oceanographer at the British Antarctic Survey and joins us now from Antarctica. Good morning, Dr. Davis.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for joining us from London. I can see, I've got the privilege of seeing you on the screen in front of me. Just describe for our listeners where you are, if you would.
Yeah, so I'm standing in our science tent. It's a big dome. Around me are all the tools we need to investigate this glacier. I'm dressed up in multiple layers of clothing. It's actually gone midnight here, but the sun's still out, but it's cold, it's windy. So I'm trying to stay toasty and warm while speaking to you.
And what are you doing there? Why are you trying to find out more about the Thwaites Glacier? Tell us a bit about it.
So fundamentally, we're trying to answer the question of how much sea level rise are we going to get in the UK in the next 100 years? So we know that how this glacier evolves over that time will set really the key contributor to sea level rise from Antarctica. So we want to understand how it's melting and how it's going to evolve in the next 100 years.
And what have you and your team managed through rather brilliant engineering to do that hasn't been done before, specifically getting to the sort of levels beneath 2,000 metres of ice?
Yeah, so this main trunk of Thwaites is a really difficult place to work. You have to have good weather. You have to have good sea ice conditions so you can get close enough with a boat. You then have to fly helicopters onto the ice and find a safe place to work in amongst this kind of jumbled mess of crevasses and broken up ice cliffs. So logistically, it's really challenging. And then also to bring all the engineering, the hot water drill, to be able to drill in this environment where everything's trying to freeze. Everything's trying to shut you down. The weather wants to shut you down. It's a huge challenge for us to be where we are right now.
How do you drill 2,000 metres down through such thick ice?
So we use this hot water drill. And basically, if you imagine a Kärcher pressure washer and scale it up many, many times, that's the system. So we have big tanks of water, 20,000 litres is what we start with. We have heaters, we have pumps, and we generate a high pressure flow of water at about 90 degrees. That we send down a massive pipe, more like it, just a big hose pipe, essentially an oversized hose pipe, into the ice. And we drill at about half a meter a minute. So about 30 hours we'll have drilled through the ice and have access to the ocean underneath.
What's your sense of how fast the Thwaites Glacier is indeed melting?
It's It's surprising, actually. So to get to Thwaites, we've come in on a ship, and the ship has been able to access places which no more than 10 years ago were covered in hundreds of meters of ice. There are places we've been that no human's ever been before. You know, we've been able to map parts of the seabed that no one's ever seen before. And this is all because these glaciers, these fundamental kind of sentinels of the ice on the continent, are collapsing in front of our eyes. So it's really quite sobering to see those changes happening in real time.
What do you hope to do with the data that you gather, Dr. Davis?
So what we want to understand is the key process that drives the collapse is the melting of the floating part, the ice shelf that sits in front of it. That ice shelf acts like a dam that holds the ice back on the land. So the data we're collecting is going to tell us how quickly that ice shelf is melting. How is it being eroded away from beneath, and how quickly might it disintegrate? And then when we have that knowledge, we can incorporate it into climate simulations, and that will tell us how the glacier will evolve over the next 100 years.
I find a very brief thought. To be clear, you think that that has direct implications for us here in the UK relatively soon, in the next decades?
Absolutely. So not necessarily the next decades. You know, we're talking about a sea level rise over the next 100, 200, 300 years. And okay, that might seem like a long period of time for many people, but in terms of infrastructure planning, that's not very long. You know, central London is at sea level. It's protected by the Thames barrier. If we were to see 50 centimeters of sea level rise by the end of the century, that barrier will need to be re-engineered to protect London from flooding.
Understood.
So it's fundamentally true that what happens in Antarctica has a significant impact on what happens in the UK.
Dr. Peter Davis from the British Antarctic Survey and in Antarctica. Thank you very much indeed for joining us.
You don't get to say that every day. Yeah. Brilliant. It's really brilliant. Let's look ahead now to later this morning on Radio 4.
The buzz. When I go for a run and I have an idea.
I'm John Wilson, and on This Cultural Life, I meet some of the world's leading artistic figures to explore the people, the places, and the cultural works that have inspired them. So far in this series, we've heard from comedian and actor Ricky Gervais, photographer Annie Leibovitz, and in the next episode, discussing his life on stage and screen, actor Jonathan Pryce.
How I got into performing and acting was there were more people saying they liked my acting than had ever said they liked my painting.
Listen to This Cultural Life this morning at 11 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
To minute to eight, let's go to Sarah Keith Lucas with the weather.
Thanks, Amal. We've got some mist and fog out there this morning, particularly dense fog across parts of central and southern England. That should clear away over the next few hours, but do watch out on the roads. Certainly some reduced visibility is around this morning. Now, for most of us, once that clears away, we're looking at a largely dry day. Will be some scattered showers on and off for southwest England, perhaps southwest Wales, and also for eastern Scotland, some showers that are falling as snow over the highest ground. Elsewhere, sunny spells around for a time this morning, but the cloud generally builds through the day, so looking rather grey and chilly into the afternoon, with top temperatures between about 5 to 9 degrees for most of us. And then we've got more rain and strengthening winds, which are quite unwelcome, from the southwest later in the day.
Sarah, thank you so much. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Amol Rajan.
Good morning. It's 8 o'clock on Thursday, the 29th of January. The headlines. Sir Keir Starmer says his meeting with President Xi in Beijing has produced real concrete outcomes. Critics have said the Prime Minister is appeasing a country which poses a security threat, but he insisted it was in the UK's national interest to engage. We'll take an in-depth look at the man Starmer's just met with for an hour and 20 minutes, we're told, President Xi, at 10 past eight. And a leading backer of the assisted dying bill says it has no hope of becoming law unless the House of Lords changes its approach.
Coming up before 9 o'clock, the very personal story of former Home Secretary Sajid Javid and what it was like growing up in 1970s Britain as the son of Punjabi immigrants. He's written a memoir and he's giving us the first broadcast interview. He'll join us in the studio after 8:30. And...
Hi, Mr. President. Congratulations.
Did you watch it?
I did not. Yeah, I will see it on the news.
Well, in case you haven't got your tickets yet, that's from the teaser for the Amazon-produced documentary about Melania Trump, which comes out tomorrow. But what does the $75 million production tell us about media, politics, and how we see the First Lady? Helen Lewis will be with us at 8:20. But first, the news is read by Jane Steele.
In the past hour, Sir Keir Starmer has described his talks with President Xi in Beijing as productive and says progress has been made on whisky tariffs, visa-free travel and disrupting the supply of engines used in small boats. The meeting was the most important part of Sir Keir's three-day trip to the country, the first by a prime minister since Theresa May in 2018. He said the discussion was a real strengthening of the relationship.
There are huge opportunities here in China. It's the second biggest economy in the world. And that's why we've got such a big business delegation. A lot of the discussion was about how we open up access for those opportunities, focusing, as I always do, on how is this going to be delivered back in the United Kingdom? How does it benefit people back at home?
Our political editor, Chris Mason, is travelling with the Prime Minister.
Against the backdrop of Beijing's Forbidden City, the Prime Minister reflected on his meeting, which lasted, we're told, 1 hour and 20 minutes. Is President Xi a man you can do business with, he was asked. Yes, he replied. This visit is a three-day exercise in defrosting relations between London and Beijing. The language and tone of the public exchanges at the start of the meeting appeared warm. President Xi pointedly praised Labour governments for what he saw as a history of deepening ties between the two countries. The Prime Minister said the talks brought progress on cutting whisky tariffs and the prospect of visa-free travel to China for British visitors. But no talk of progress rather than a deal on either. President Xi talked of a turbulent and fluid world. The clear subtext, China a beacon of stability amid President Trump's whims, outbursts and unpredictability.
Sir Keir gave President Xi a used football from a recent match between the Prime Minister's team, Arsenal, and what's reported to be the Chinese leader's favourite side, Manchester United. With her assessment of the meeting, here's our China correspondent, Laura Bicker.
The Chinese president framed his meeting with Sir Keir Starmer not just in terms of what it meant for business between the UK and China, but what it meant in global terms. For President Xi, these visits by Western leaders from Canada, France and now Britain, all looking to reset their relationship with China, are taking part at a time when Western alliances are being strained by an unpredictable US president who continues to threaten his partners with trade tariffs. Mr. Xi described the state of the world as turbulent and fluid, and that he believed talks between the two nations was imperative for the sake of world peace and stability. He also pushed back against accusations that China is a security threat. Beijing is playing a long diplomatic game here to try to restore its historical status as a global power in the hope that it can soon rival US influence.
A leading backer of the assisted dying bill has told the BBC it is very, very difficult to see how it can become law in England and Wales this year because of strong resistance in the House of Lords. More than 1,000 amendments were tabled. The Labour peer, Lord Falconer, said he was considering the unprecedented use of powers under the Parliament Act to override the Lords if the bill wasn't passed before the King's speech. He's been speaking to our political correspondent, Harry Farley.
Time is running out for the assisted dying legislation to pass before the end of this parliamentary session, expected in May. The persistence of opposition in the Lords has led its sponsor, Lord Falconer, to say the legislation now has absolutely no hope of passing without a fundamental change in peers' approach. According to a government source, ministers are suggesting a compromise, such as setting up a royal commission, could provide a way forward if it doesn't pass. But the architects of the bill say they will use arcane powers under the Parliament Act to bring it back. If an identical replica bill passed the Commons a second time, peers would not be able to block it again. Critics say this would mean forcing a flawed bill into law with no ability to change it. A source close to Labour opponents of assisted dying said the threat was the act of a bully who knew they were losing the argument. But Lord Falconer argues if elected MPs have passed the bill, then peers should not be able to block it.
The European Union's top diplomat, Kaya Kallas, says she expects the bloc to add Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guards to its list of terrorist organisations. She said earlier this month that Brussels was preparing new sanctions in response to Tehran's violent crackdown against protesters. President Trump has again threatened military action against Iran and has warned that time is running out for it to negotiate a deal on its nuclear programme. A team of scientists from the UK and South Korea have set up camp on one of the most inaccessible and unstable glaciers in Antarctica. Over the next 2 weeks, they will use hot water to drill a kilometre through the ice to gather data to help them estimate how quickly seas may rise around the world. Our climate editor Justin Rowlatt, one of only a handful of journalists to have ever visited Thwaites, has this report.
Thwaites Glacier has been nicknamed the Doomsday Glacier. The size of Britain, it acts as a natural barrier, holding back neighbouring glaciers in West Antarctica. If they all melt, it would raise global sea levels by some 3 metres, enough to cause devastating flooding to low-lying towns and cities across the UK. And satellite observations show Thwaites is melting increasingly rapidly. The scientists from the British Antarctic Survey and the Korea Polar Research Institute plan to lower instruments through the hole in the ice and relay the first real-time measurements of ocean temperatures and currents at the grounding line, the point where the glacier lifts from the seabed to form a floating ice shelf.
Schools in England are to be told not to automatically send children home if they are suspended. The Education Secretary, Bridget Phillipson, said sending children home could mean they retreat to social media and that on-site suspension should be used for those who haven't been violent so they don't miss out on learning. Steve Chalk, the founder of the Oasis Charitable Trust, which runs 55 schools, told us the approach could work provided schools are given the resources to support students effectively.
It is socioeconomically underserved communities that are far overrepresented in terms of suspensions. If you look at the figures, they're prone to falling into violence, danger, being groomed, becoming mules in gangs. But we've got to get deeper than that, because we've got to ask, what are the resources for schools to do this who are already overstretched? Is this child going to end up sitting in isolation in a box?
The electric car maker Tesla has experienced its first ever annual decline in revenue. It fell 3% last year. Elon Musk's company is to stop production of two models and shift more of its production to humanoid robots. Here's our North America technology correspondent, Lily Jamali.
Tesla was once one of the world's most profitable car companies, but now it says profits dropped 61% in the final quarter of 2025 compared with the previous year. The electric vehicle company has struggled to keep up with China's BYD, and boss Elon Musk's foray into U.S. politics last year likely also dragged on the company's fortunes. Tesla plans to end production of its Model S and Model X vehicles as sales of both models have faltered, with the company shifting its focus to AI and robotics. Its California manufacturing plant will aim to produce 1 million Optimus robots a year, and Tesla will invest $2 billion into Musk's artificial intelligence company, XAI.
The Culture Secretary is being urged to step in and save Britain's oldest roller coaster from closure. The owners of the Dreamland Amusement Park in Margate say the scenic railway ride is no longer viable. But the local council has written to Lisa Nandy, insisting the ride is of international importance. Simon Jones reports.
After more than 100 years, the Grade 2 listed wooden roller coaster appears to have reached the end of the tracks. The scenic railway has been out of action since developing a structural fault in 2024. Now the owners of Dreamland say following inspections, it can no longer be maintained as a viable ride. There have been claims that up to 5 hours of safety checks would be required every day. Dreamland instead want to, in their words, reimagine the roller coaster's purpose and are asking the public for ideas. But Thanet Council says the attraction is a huge part of Britain's seaside heritage. It's asking the Culture Secretary to consider whether its listed status means it should be protected not only structurally but also operationally, which would allow generations to come to enjoy the thrill of the fair.
Simon Jones reporting.
Dame, thank you. It's 10 minutes past eight. We can deliver a result that can withstand the test of history. The words of Xi Jinping as he met Sir Keir Starmer a few hours ago. China's president said his country's relationship with Britain had gone through twists and turns in recent years, serving the interests of neither country. We hear a lot of what the UK should be asking of China, the hopes of greater trade, the fears on security, the concerns about human rights. But what does President Xi himself want from this relationship, and indeed from China's approach to the world as a whole? Let's try to answer that question, to get to know the man a little, with two people who have been observing and watching President Xi for years. Kerry Brown, author of Xi, A Study in Power. He's the director of the Lao China Institute at King's College London and former First Secretary at the British Embassy in Beijing. And also Su Lin Wong, Asia correspondent at The Economist. She's the host of the podcast The Prince, which tells the story of President Xi's rise to power. Welcome to you both. Kerry, if I start with you, I mean, what do we need to know as a bit of a primer, just thinking about this meeting, about the man, about President Xi?
Well, he's an instinctive politician. I mean, I've met him once in 2007, so before he really was elevated. But you could tell that he can play a room. I mean, he's good at kind of the public performance of politics. So he's similar in some ways to Western politicians. But his background is, you know, kind of red aristocracy, as people say. I mean, his father was a senior leader, although he went through great troubles in parts of his career. Xi Jinping is a tough cookie. I mean, he was from the age of, you know, kind of as an adolescent, quite a young adolescent, was sent down to the countryside and had to kind of basically do without an education. And since then, he's really sort of shaped himself as a nationalist populist. So he is the man in control of a country when finally, after the travails of modern history, it's on the up. It's making China great again. I mean, it's the great, you know, kind of economic revival and also a cultural revival. So he has an air of a man of destiny about him.
Su Lin, that childhood that Kerry was just referring to there, and how he was effectively groomed for power in some ways, or at least feels like he's continuing a dynasty and an approach, a very specific approach. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, so Xi Jinping was born into Chinese Communist Party royalty. His father fought in the revolution alongside Mao Zedong. And if you can imagine, as a kid growing up, sitting around the dinner table, hearing stories of the hardship and the suffering that your parents went through, but also the prospect of, you know, a new China, one that was going to be stronger and more powerful. And you would be told from a very young age that you were going to inherit this legacy. And you actually end up being able to do that. And so Xi Jinping now really does see himself as a man on a mission to, quote unquote, make China great again. Now, in fact, he suffered a lot, as Kerry was saying, during his childhood. He lived through the madness of the Cultural Revolution, where, you know, Mao's Red Guards were unleashed and beat and tortured and killed people. He almost was killed himself. And what's really extraordinary about his story is that, unlike a lot of other sort of Communist Party elites who turned away from the party, Xi Jinping actually doubled down and he decided to commit himself to the Chinese Communist Party. And his lesson from the madness of the Cultural Revolution was that it was crucial that the Chinese Communist Party never, ever lose control again. And so I think that's really important when trying to understand who Xi Jinping is today.
And Kerry, on that point of control, how has he managed to assert such control over China, over the Communist Party, over the people?
Well, Xi Jinping is a man of faith, and the Communist Party is almost like the Catholic Church. It's a knowledge community, a faith community. It's not like a political party in the West. It occupies all of the political territory. You either do politics in the party or you don't do politics in China. That's the deal. Xi Jinping is kind of the true believer. I think he is a true believer. He said even before coming to power, the ultimate power, that when he was in Fujian province in the south east of the country, you shouldn't do politics if you want to do business. So he's kept the divide between politics and business with these extensive anti-corruption campaigns, the most recent of which has hit the People's Liberation Army. So he's a kind of quite an ideological figure. But I think that he regards China as very special, very unique, a kind of culturally exceptionalist country. And I guess he's in charge of this identity politics with Chinese characteristics. Today, it is cool to be Chinese after 150 years of being marginalized and sort of on the edge of everything. Today, he is presiding over this great sort of resurrection of a country back to its status as a central power. And that nationalist mission is accompanied by a kind of general failing in the world around. I think the Chinese rightly or wrongly see America as a declining power. And that's probably something that Starmer and Xi talked about in Beijing, because America is unpredictable now in ways it never was before. And in a weird way, Britain and China are trying to work this out in very different contexts. So they have a common point they never had before. What do we do about America?
Sulin, there's been a concern, though, about the, you know, our Prime Minister going to China because of issues around human rights, to say the very least. You know, if we were painting an image of the man and control and power, we can't not mention some of the serious abuses and some of the serious crimes.
Yeah, that's right. When Xi Jinping first came to power 13 years ago, his overwhelming priority was to make the party and, by extension, the whole country responsive to his leadership. And he's been incredibly successful of that. And a lot of that has been to do with enormous crackdowns that have targeted corruption, but also, you know, press freedom and human rights lawyers and people who just didn't execute on his priorities or who he saw as potential challenges. And, you know, fast forward 13 years to 2026, and we see a China that's far more centralized, far less tolerant of dissent, far more xenophobic than it was before he came to power.
And I suppose knowing that and knowing some, you know, details of the specific cases, not least Jimmy Lai, and, you know, what people, of course, have been reporting and exceptionally concerned about the plight of the Uyghur Muslims. Keeping all that in mind, how does Britain fit into this worldview and to the goals, Kerry?
Well, Britain is a middle-ranking power. It matters to China because it's still a significant economy. It's got a long history going back four centuries with China, so we're not new partners. We're the second, China is Britain's second largest research partner. In life sciences, we're very important. There's very little Chinese investment in Britain, 0.2% of our stocks. But, you know, as a member of NATO, as a member of the P5, of the Five Eyes intelligence sharing, Britain matters. And so I don't think, you know, Xi Jinping is dismissive of Britain. Their traditional interests here have been finance, a high kind of technology investment as a platform, and of course the fact they've got 100,000 students in universities in Britain. So it's a significant relationship. It has not been a consistent relationship over the last 10 years. There's a hope that now we have a pragmatic framework to work in because the geopolitics surrounding this visit is very, very turbulent. And I think for China, basically, they see an opportunity to do something for their reputation now that America is so troubled. But also they don't want big responsibilities because they have massive demographic, environmental, and their own economic problems to deal with. And I think that will take them a while to deal with those before they start marching out in the world and trying to run the rest of it for us. I don't think that's going to happen, not in my lifetime, probably not in any of my children's lifetimes.
Sulin, though, around this concern around trying to split the West and the long game and how that, you know, may be something to be concerned about from the perspective of Britain, what do you say to that?
Well, I think Xi Jinping is a cynical realist. He's incredibly pragmatic in how he executes his foreign policy. And I think it's easy for us to sit in the West, sit in the UK and say, oh, you know, when Xi Jinping wakes up in the morning, he's thinking, how do I improve relations with the UK? But in reality, it's just not that high on his list of priorities. Xi Jinping cares about controlling the party, controlling China, making China as strong as possible. He's you know, China for China. And if the UK can help him in doing that, if the UK can buy Chinese EVs, can, you know, buy goods that China really cares about right now in the sense that it wants to become this technological superpower, then great. But, you know, I think that's really how Xi Jinping views the UK-China relationship, as, you know, what can China get out of it? How can the UK help China achieve its priorities and its goals?
Kerry, just coming to final thoughts on this and what you know of President Xi. The thought of an hour and 20 meeting between him and Sir Keir Starmer, we've had a few readouts, we've had some insights, and then there'll be some more details later. The Prime Minister's now about to go on a tour, I believe, of the Forbidden City as the trip continues. What do you think could be achieved, will be achieved, and how do you think the Prime Minister has played it and can play it with a character like President Xi?
So there hasn't been a Prime Minister visit from Britain to China for 8 years. In that time, China has become a technology superpower. That's how quick things have happened. It is way ahead in AI, quantum computing, pharma, areas that we once assumed were, you know, kind of advantages for Britain and the West. We have to work out what that means to us. Do we need to do technology transfer where China gives some technology back to us after we gave so much, you know, illicitly during the previous 20 years? China is a technology superpower. It's a new story. Our politicians don't understand it. It's real. It is changing the world. It's changing China. And we have to be, we have to know that as an opportunity cost. We don't have to engage with it. But in areas like cancer treatment, which matter to us, environmental science, China is now really important. And I hope this visit at least creates a framework for us to engage with that story rather than always shaking our heads and saying no.
Kerry Brown, Soon Lin Wong, thank you very much for your time and insight, sir.
21 minutes past eight. Once upon a time, a long, long time ago, if you were a powerful member of the elite, you might have your portrait painted or maybe a statue commissioned. These days, perhaps you're more likely to get a hagiographic documentary made by a tech giant. In case you didn't know, Melania is released in cinemas tomorrow, promising a behind-the-scenes look at America's First Lady, particularly during the weeks before the 2025 presidential inauguration. What does this documentary tell us about modern power and indeed about the changing nature of first ladies? Well, in a moment, we'll hear from Helen Lewis, staff writer at The Atlantic, frequent voice on Radio 4 and author of, among other books, Difficult Women, A History of Feminism in 11 Fights. Before we hear from Helen, here's a clip from the trailer, courtesy, of course, of Amazon MGM Studios.
Together with like-minded leaders, we have a voice. Is it safe?
It is safe.
Everyone wants to know. So here it is.
Well, when I spoke to Helen Lewis a short time ago, I started by asking her what both Amazon on the one hand and the Trump family on the other are getting out of this project.
Amazon has, shall we say, burnished its relationship with the Trump White House. Obviously, that's something that Jeff Bezos has been very keen to do. The other thing he does, obviously, is owns the Washington Post, which refused to endorse Kamala Harris very notoriously at the last presidential election. So really, he's, you know, he is somebody who values very closely this relationship that he has with the Trump White House. So they've paid $40 million to make this. Most of that is reportedly gone to Melania Trump herself, plus another $35 million to market it. And, you know, she is an executive producer on this. So it's a big gift-wrapped present to the Trump White House, really. And as for Melania Trump, she's somebody who has really stayed massively in the background. You know, I think she's a fascinating first lady because she's upended so many of our assumptions about American politics and the role of the first lady. She barely appeared on the campaign trail. She did the Madison Square Garden rally right at the end, but she didn't even speak at the Republican National Convention in 2024. So everything we thought we knew about the fact you needed a first lady kind of gazing adoringly at the great man, she just went, no, I'd rather not, actually. No, thank you.
And just on the genre that she has now entered, this is part of a recent spate of films, isn't it? Not just from Amazon, but others, including other streamers like Netflix, where you get people to executive produce documentaries about their own lives, which cast them in a rather flattering light. Less biography, more hagiography.
Absolutely. I mean, the two documentaries on Netflix about the Beckhams are another really good example of this. They're very much the authorised version of the life, you know. And that's the thing. I don't think we'll learn anything enormously insightful from the Melania documentary. What we will learn is the storyline she wants to tell. What's the image that she wants to present? What's the story she feels that she's telling about her life?
It's interesting you mentioned what distinguishes her as a first lady. Are there slightly different expectations of first ladies in America, particularly perhaps Trump's America, compared to how we think about first ladies here in the UK?
Well, I should say on both sides of the Atlantic, first ladies or wives of prime ministers have traditionally absolutely hated the job.
It's a dreadful job, isn't it? It's a dreadful
job. Yeah, I think Cherie Blair used to refer to it as, you know, living in the goldfish bowl, essentially. And the idea is basically either you're kind of, you know, you're not into it, in which case you're insufficiently supportive of your husband, or you know, too enthusiastic, in which case you're a self-promoter. You don't spend enough money, in which case you're dowdy, you know, or you spend too much money, in which case you're a kind of Marie Antoinette figure who's, you know, who's embarrassing the nation. There's no real way to win at it.
And one thing that might drive interest in this film is there has been hitherto this kind of contrast between Trump's immense availability on all platforms at all times and the fact that she has been somewhat enigmatic, somewhat distant, somewhat hard to know.
Yeah, it's extraordinary, really, how little she has engaged in publicity. You know, she notoriously she used to talk to her parents who lived in the White House with her in the first term and her son Barron in Slovenian and sort of lock Donald Trump out. You know, even in the trailer for the film, you know, all you see her is her saying a couple of slightly icy things and then Trump phoning her when she's in their New York apartment and just ask if she's watched something. And she says, no, I'll watch it on television later. You know, there's a kind of like lack of being botheredness about it, which means that people have had to overread enormously from the few things that they do have. So she, one of her causes, a traditional First Lady cause, has been children. She went to visit victims of the Trump regime's family separation policy at the border, splitting up immigrant children from their parents. And she did that wearing a jacket that on the back said, almost unbelievably, "I don't really care, do you?" and literally no one knew what to make of this. She wrote in her autobiography, which was a masterpiece of total blandness, that this was terrible. How could the media overread from it? But there are almost no other statements from her of any significance. So that has sort of been her biggest public statement to date, really. A jacket.
Helen Lewis from The Atlantic and author of Difficult Women. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
There you go. 26 minutes past eight. Let's turn our attention back to what we were saying before around social media bans and a potential social media ban for under 16s, the rights and wrongs of putting that into law, as well as the role of phones in schools. On Friday's programme, tomorrow, in fact, we are going to be looking in more detail at how this plays out in the home, how parents handle their family's use of social media and screen time more generally. And you have been getting in touch. Please continue to do so. Rebecca has emailed in saying, I have three children and I've become stricter over time. My eldest two got a smartphone just before the end of year six, but my youngest, who's 11, will be getting a dumb phone, a brick phone, if you know it as that. No phones when doing homework, no phones after 9 p.m, no phones in rooms at night. We stick to age restrictions on social media apps and some we've just banned. Despite the rules, it is a constant battle and cause of resentment. Meanwhile, myself and my husband are utter hypocrites. Good on you with the honesty, Rebecca. And use our phones far too much. We're the ones who need fixing. I often think it's not simply the presence of social media and screen use, but the absence of other things, such as unsupervised outdoor time with friends, independence, and too much time with parents, etc., which can contribute to kids' problems.
We always get lots of messages, but we really have had a huge number on this subject and very strong feeling as well. Georgia sent in this message. Thank you, Georgia. She said, I have two teenagers, both with autism, ADHD and anxiety. My youngest, now 15, had no school place for 4 years due to local authority failures. My eldest, now 19, had no school place for 2 years and had to take GCSEs in the house. Their anxiety, sensory overload and mental breakdown from mainstream schools meant they barely left the house during these years, plus COVID. Their phones gave them their only window into the outside world during this time, allowing them to connect with friends and family and helping them to regulate themselves. A social media ban is a blunt tool that will discriminate against neurodiverse children and teenagers. Instead, let's force social media companies to make their spaces safe for everyone, especially teenagers.
We do want to hear from you. More messages on top of those excellent ones. What are the conversations you've had with your children or your grandchildren, and what limits or rules do you set around social media, screens and phones? And to the message that came in, we were just hearing from Rebecca, what are you modelling? What about your own behaviour? Send us a message or voice note on WhatsApp 0330 1234 346. That's 0330 1234 346. Or you can email us, as always, today at bbc.co.uk.
And we're going to hear from lots of experts and parents on the programme tomorrow, towards the back end of the programme in particular, to share some advice, practical, useful advice, and also share their experiences.
Someone who's often on a screen, looking at them all for us across the sporting world. Mike's here. Hello, Mike.
Well, yes, I was going to say, Emma, if your daily screen time limit allows, and you like football, might I humbly suggest that you head to the BBC Sport website and app this morning, where you can watch all 61 goals from a breathless night in the Champions League last night, which ended with 5 of the 6 English clubs qualifying directly for the last 16. Newcastle will face a playoff, and you can see all the goals, as we say, online, including that incredible stoppage time winner for Benfica against Real Madrid, scored by their goalkeeper. We now, though, are going to talk boxing, because look who's back again.
I told y'all there was a big announcement coming today, baby! I'm absolutely psyched, ready today to fight. Come on! April, UK, I've been away for a while, but I'm back now. This is just the tip of the iceberg. Let's go! He's back.
Yes, the shy and retiring Tyson Fury there announcing his latest return to boxing yesterday. The former heavyweight champion will come out of retirement once again at the age of 37 to face the Russian Arslanbek Makhmudov here in the UK on the 11th of April. Well, Five Live Boxing Steve Bunce joins us on the programme. Hi, Steve.
Morning, Mike. I guess that's the shy and not retiring Tyson Fury, in all fairness. Good Mike, point, not retiring again, we should add.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, very good point to pick me up on because, I mean, boxer comes out of retirement isn't a story, isn't it? Particularly with Fury, who, as we say, has had had more comebacks than Elvis Presley. But why is he doing it now?
Well, I'd like to try and tell you it's because he wants to regain the World Heavyweight Championship of the world and he wants to give something back to the people because he believes there aren't any stars in boxing. I'd like to say that. But because he's chosen the platform Netflix, it's because of money. It's because of money and the fact that he needs boxing, not in the sense that he needs the money, because he certainly doesn't need that. He might be one of the wealthiest, top five wealthiest boxers in history. But he needs the rigors of training. He needs the what he calls his rehab, which is being in the gym. And he already looks slimmer. He's, in the last 2 months, he's transformed his body. And if he's transformed his body, that means he's transforming his mind. So that's why he's back. Part of it is his health. And the other part is the stash of cash he's going to whack in his back pocket because it will be considerable.
As ever in boxing, money talks. But interesting you mention Netflix, the second big fight in as many months that the streaming platform has had. They had the Joshua-Jake Paul fight, didn't they, last month. Are they now a serious contender in boxing broadcasting?
Well, this is their fifth fight in about 14 or so, or 15 or so months. And they've all been, it's a cliche, they've all been blockbusters. They've all been enormous in their own way. Giant crowds outdoors, enormous sellouts indoors, but also fights with a little bit of a story. The first fight they launched in November 2024 was Jake Paul, the one-time Disney star, against Mike Tyson. Yes, Mike Tyson, he was 57, I believe, at the time. The last one was Jake Paul again against Anthony Joshua just 10 days before that terrible crash in Nigeria that Joshua was involved in. Are they big players? Absolutely, because they're a big platform. Are they going to change the shape of boxing going forward? No, they're not. But every now and again, every 2 or 3 months, they can have a giant event. It makes everybody in the boxing business look up, take notice, and that's not bad for our business.
Just briefly, Steve, where's the fight going to be?
I think it's going to be indoors. I think it's going to be at the Co-op. I really do. 22, not your local Co-op, the Co-op Arena in Manchester I'm talking about. 22,000 people, April the 11th. Get your tickets. Oops, they've sold out already. There you go.
We shall see. Steve Bunce, as ever, many thanks for that. You can hear the latest from Steve and all things boxing, of course, right now on the Five Live Boxing Podcast on BBC Sounds.
Thank you very much indeed, Mike. It is 27 minutes to 9, and here to tell us about In Our Time is Misha Glenny. Morning, Misha.
Morning, Emil. Well, we'll be discussing the Roman Arena today, the venue for deadly games with gladiators, wild beasts and even sea battles for over 500 years. Now, gladiatorial combat was at the centre of successive emperors' strategy of bread and circuses, so keep the mob happy and distracted from any idea of political engagement. Behind the scenes, though, the Roman arenas generated huge sums of money for the impresarios, traders in wild animals, while the gladiators themselves could, in some cases, win their freedom in recognition of their fighting skills. That's the Roman Arena with Matthew Nichols, Kathleen Coleman and John Pierce on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds just after 9 o'clock. Now back to Amal and Emma at the Today studio.
Misha, thank you for that. Looking forward to it. Are we looking forward to the weather? Let's have a look. Today will be a largely cloudy day with some mist around in places to start, but it should remain mainly dry with only the odd light isolated shower possible. It'll be breezy.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Amal Rajan. It's 25 minutes to 9. Here's a summary of the news from Jane Steele.
Sir Keir Starmer says he has held a productive meeting in Beijing with China's President Xi Jinping. The Prime Minister said they made progress on whisky tariffs, visa-free travel and disrupting the supply chain of engines used for small boat crossings. He added that the UK's relationship with China was in a very good, strong place. A leading backer of the assisted dying bill has told the BBC it is very, very difficult to see how it could become law in England and Wales this year. The Labour peer, Lord Faulkner, says he is considering the unprecedented use of powers under the Parliament Act to override opposition from the Lords. Santander Bank has announced plans to close 44 branches. Nearly 300 jobs are at risk. Elon Musk's Tesla has reported its first ever annual drop in revenue. The electric vehicle manufacturer said its profits dropped by 61% in the last quarter of 2025.
Jane, thank you very much indeed. It's 24 minutes to nine. Is the assisted dying bill itself dying? Once trumpeted as the signature domestic social reform of Keir Starmer's government, proponents say it's now stuck in a veritable morass of legislative bickering designed not to scrutinise and thus improve the law, but to keep things as they are. We spent a great deal of time on this programme examining the ethics of the reforms. We want to spend a few minutes today looking at the parliamentary process, because Lord Faulkner, who's joined us in the studio, is saying that the rarely invoked Parliament Act may be necessary, may be required to force this through. His opponents suggest that could cause a spot of major constitutional bother. Well, we'll hear from Lord Faulkner, who's smiling on hearing that, in a moment. But first, let's speak to Nikki Da Costa, who's a former Director of Legislative Affairs in Number 10. Nikki, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, what do you make of the notion that the Parliament Act may be invoked here?
I do think it's extraordinary. We have complex, sensitive legislation, which is about how doctors end the lives of very vulnerable patients. And it's full of holes. Five royal colleges can't support it. And you've got numerous external organisations saying there are problems, and three select committee reports in the Lords saying there's dangers. Now, for 5 months, Lord Faulkner has not engaged with the problems. So we've got a problem almost of Lord Faulkner's making. And 10 days ago, he said, oh, I must change my ways. But nothing's happened. So what do you have a situation in the Lords where you've got these very detailed amendments trying to address the issues. And because of the lack of engagement, you've got this crisis that's been created. Now, what that means is he wants MPs in the next session to vote for the same unsafe, deficient bill, which has no electoral mandate, and force it onto the statute books. Now, there's a lot of complexity in achieving that path, but that's what it would require.
Okay,
for
well,
the MPs to be blind to the vulnerable.
I think I get the impression, I've got the pleasure of looking at his face as you speak to us, and I can tell you that he's looking forward to answering some of those claims. Can I just put to you, Nikki, first of all, the idea that what's really going on here is a bit of old-fashioned filibustering. There's an attempt, basically, by some people, this is what your opponents would say, to basically put some, you know, sand in the eyes to slow this thing down until it runs out of time in May, in the hope that, because if you put more delays in place, essentially this reform's not going to happen. Isn't that what's really going on?
So first, you've got to start with the process. This is going by the private members bill process. Process never designed for complex bills of this nature and ones that are this unsafe. Secondly, the Lord is moving at about the same pace as the Commons. They've got through about 300 amendments so far, spending about 7 minutes on each amendment, and they're doing the best to patch these holes. They're responding to external concerns. You know, this bill managed to provoke two royal colleges, psychiatrists and physicians, from 4 years of neutrality out to saying that this bill, while they're neutral on principle, this bill is unsafe. This bill is dangerous for the vulnerable and people will be failed. So you've got a situation where Lord Faulkner wants the Lords as a scrutinising chamber to stop doing the work and just wave it through. And it's a lot of, I think it's very easy for proponents to take it up into this binary. It's Lords versus Commons versus, is this bill safe? And the work has not been done.
OK. Nikki Da Costa, thank you very much indeed. Lord Faulkner, there's quite a bit to put to you. Whether it's unsafe, deficient and has no mandate, we've actually discussed before. But there's actually quite a lot of personal stuff about you in there, which is that you've not turned up, you've not engaged. And what you're trying to do is defy the will of lots of people who are concerned about the ethics of this bill.
I mean, not turned up seems a little bit extreme. I've turned up every day. I'm the only person who's been there every day. As far as the engaged, I'm engaged repeatedly, right from the process when it started. I invited peers to come and see me. I spoke to peers. I have given detailed indications of the changes I'm going to make. The suggestion that I haven't engaged is completely wrong. What is going on here is a minority are engaged in a filibuster. The Lords themselves have recognised that by passing a motion on the 8th of January saying, we want more time, we want this finished. And perhaps the strongest indication of that is that we've been doing 7 days of committee so far. It's about 5 hours a day, over 35 hours, and we haven't got through section one yet. If there are defects in this bill, and I accept it can be improved, but I don't think it's a defective bill, then make the changes. If I resist the changes, then vote them through. The Lords is a sensible place. What the Lords does well is look at things and change them if they're wrong. Stop all this smoke and mirrors that we got from Nicky DaCosta there and focus on making the bill better. If you say that's what's wrong with it.
Why do you believe this requires an unprecedented use of the Parliament Act?
Because what's happening is the Commons, after detailed scrutiny, have decided there should be this major change. The Lords, because of this minority filibustering, will not engage in detail. We haven't even got to the bit where we vote changes yet, because we haven't even got past Section 1 yet. The Constitution says if the Commons passes something and the Lords block it, which is what's happening, then the way the Commons, who are elected, get their way is if they pass it again, second time, in the same form, then it gets through without the Lords. Don't do that, I'm saying to the Lords. If you want to make changes to make it better, start engaging with the detail. The majority are trying to do that.
That's you're a lawyer by training. That's a strict interpretation of the Constitution. Doesn't it rather undermine the Lords, though, if you were to use a Parliament Act to do away with the objections that people like Nicky DaCosta have?
It does undermine the Lords if the Lords will not engage in the process.
But they say you're not engaging.
But they've got to engage. We've got to be faster than Section 1. And they can improve this bill. I recognise that. And I've indicated a whole range of areas where I will accept changes. But if the Lords will just not move on, then they can't do their work. And what's made the Lords successful in a number of respects is because they do good scrutiny. And my experience, this is pretty unprecedented for the Lords not properly to engage in it.
Do you think they're acting cynically rather than in good faith?
I think there are a lot of people, often with religious motives, which I respect, who do not want to see this bill. Ultimately, somebody's got to decide whether we're going to make this change. And it can't be the Lords, it's got to be the elected House of Commons, and they've made a clear decision.
Let me put that to Nicky DaCosta. Nicky DaCosta, it's got to be the elected Commons in the end.
Absolutely, you get to that stage, but let me give you five things that Lord Faulkner has confirmed in the last few days of debate. If you're terminally ill but want to end your life because of poverty, you should be helped to do so. If society or loved ones make you feel that you're a burden, it's okay for doctors to help end your life. If you're terminally ill and have Down syndrome or learning disabilities, it's still okay for doctors to proactively raise ending your life. There should be no particular care where a woman is pregnant before providing lethal substance to kill her, and the terminally ill need not be given a real choice or equal right to palliative care. These are major issues, and these ones Lord Faulkner will not engage with.
I've engaged with every single one of them. What on earth is she talking about?
I've listened to every hour of that debate, and you batted all those away.
Disagreed, that's all.
Absolutely, and those are the major...
Isn't that allowed? Disagreement?
What you have offered is very minor. It's usually changes to codes of practice, training requirements, and you haven't engaged with the detail. You've said that on the floor of the House on the last two Fridays.
But if the position is we disagree, Nikki, then the answer is vote against it and change it. Why?
And you're Lord Faulkner. The House needs to hear the issues. The House decides.
The House has heard them.
Not Lord Faulkner.
Well, the House has heard them, and our listeners have heard them. I think this is democracy in action. You guys can continue this in the House of Lords whenever you like. Lord Faulkner and Nicky DaCosta, thank you both very much indeed for your time this morning.
16 minutes to nine. Let's take our politics to Wales then for a moment, shall we? As we did earlier in the programme, the hotly contested Senedd elections are coming on May 7th. They could cause a political earthquake because Labour could lose power in Wales, which would be seismic, as it's been the biggest party in the country at every UK parliamentary election since 1922 and the largest in the Senedd at every election since 1999. Earlier, we heard from the leader of the Welsh Greens. Now we are joined by Darren Millar, leader of the Welsh Conservatives. Good morning.
Good morning, Emma.
What do you think you can do, or what do you think you need to say to appeal to those voters who may have never considered voting Conservative before and can't yet conceive of it?
Well, we are the only party that's credible and can offer an alternative to the very poor performance of our Welsh public services and the very poor performance of our economy. Labour's acted like a boa constrictor around Wales, choking the life out of it over the past 27 years with the support of Plaid Cymru and with the support of the Liberal Democrats. We've got the lowest wages in the UK, the highest unemployment rate, the longest NHS waiting list, and the poorest educational outcomes. And we need to change that.
Why is that not being reflected? Why is that not being reflected in the polls? You're in fourth.
Well, it is being reflected in the polls.
You're in fourth place. Sorry, if I could just on that, if I could share with the listeners, at the moment you're in fourth place behind Reform UK.
So what's happening at the moment is that people are blaming Labour for these failures. They're not currently associating those failures with either Plaid Cymru or the Liberal Democrats. And of course, they have been enticed by the finger wagging of Reform, which is a party which doesn't have any solutions to the problems that Wales faces. So what we have done is we've put together a credible plan to fix Wales, to get these things sorted, to improve our NHS, to improve our school performance, whilst at the same time having funded tax cuts to income tax, lowering business rates, cutting waste, and helping to get our economy moving.
Isn't that quite patronising to voters? They've been enticed by finger wagging. Maybe they've actually been put off by the Conservatives and having a look in England at what you've done or didn't do in 14 years. Isn't that very patronising to diminish why they might be going towards Reform UK? Isn't it also understandable you might want something new?
People do want something new. We've had 27 years of failure in Wales and the Labour Plaid and the Liberal Democrats. And that's why we've got an exciting package of announcements that were already made. For example, today, Emma, we're announcing grandparent childcare payments for people, up to £4,800 a year, to recognise the contribution of grandchildren to looking after children in their families as an alternative to an extended free childcare offer of up to 30 hours per week for all 9-month-olds to 4-year-olds.
Is that going to be enough? I suppose it's just there's a mixture of things going on here. How are you going to get ahead of Reform UK in the polls? The polls are not always accurate, I accept that, but it's about cutting through and making that case. There is a real a moment of opportunity in politics right now in Wales, isn't there? Because of how you've characterised what Labour have or haven't done. And I suppose at the same time, as I understand it, you're planning on declaring a national health emergency. You've supported two councils who've done that. How does that help anybody?
Well, if you declare a national health emergency in the same way that we had a health emergency during COVID, it means that there's a greater focus on getting to grips with the crisis that's in the Welsh NHS. I mean, what many of your listeners won't appreciate is that people here are hundreds of times more likely to have to wait 2 years plus for their operations and over the border. And we've got some of the worst performance in terms of our ambulance service and our emergency department services in the whole of Great Britain. So what a health emergency would allow us to do is quickly increase and boost the number of beds available in the NHS to alleviate pressures so that we can then fix those problems, clear the waiting lists and make sure that people get the safe care that they need. But of course, it's not just the NHS, Emma. We've also got plans for our education.
I know, and just as we've had all the other leaders on and we're trying to get every single one on, that's the time that I have at this moment, but you will have, I'm sure, more opportunity to share those policies. Thank you for your time this morning. That's Darren Millar, leader of the Welsh Conservatives. Earlier you heard me speak to the leader of Welsh Greens, hoping for their first ever seat. And on yesterday's programme, we spoke to the leader of Plaid Cymru and the Labour Welsh First Minister, and we are hoping to speak to all of the Welsh political parties in our look ahead to those Senate elections.
It's 11 minutes to nine when one afternoon in Weston-super-Mare in the 1970s, two brothers, originally from Rochdale but now living in Bristol, thought they had mastered the art of cheating fruit machines with a J-shaped metal wire. They met their match in a manager of an arcade and were detained in a police cell. Their father, a bus driver of Pakistani Muslim heritage, was distraught and beyond livid. He beat them, often with a shoe, and he would later shed tears when he took the rascals back in to see the police. A witness to that mischief might have been forgiven for looking at those two little brothers, and not concluding one will become one of Britain's most senior coppers, the other Britain's first Muslim Home Secretary. But so it was. The former was called Baz, the latter Sajid, as in Sajid Javid. a major figure in British politics over the past decade. His new memoir is called The Colour of Home, Growing Up in 1970s Britain, and it's shocked many readers, including this one, with its often graphic descriptions of racism, poverty, love and war in a tense but ambitious immigrant home. So Sajid Javid, former Chancellor of the Exchequer, escaped all of that to go to university and then have a distinguished career in the city before politics. He joins us now for his first broadcast interview on the book. So Sajid, good morning.
Good morning.
Is it nice to come on the Today programme without having lines to take, Spads briefing in your ear about the message that the PM wants you to land?
I feel liberated. Ask me anything you want.
You look very happy and a bit young, if I may say. Why did you write this book?
I wrote, you know, when I decided I was going to leave Parliament, I had a couple of approaches to do the sort of what I think is the typical, you know, political intrigue, tell-all, you know, got home, open my red box, those kind of stories. I don't think anyone would be interested in that. And I wanted to do something different. I wasn't interested in the political stuff. I wanted to tell my story because my hope is that when people read this book, especially those that, like me at that time as a child, that maybe thought they sort of grew up on the wrong side of the tracks and maybe opportunity was for someone else, that they might find something in this book and it might inspire them.
I have to say that the book is very gripping and it's very enjoyable, but it is quite shocking. When people talk about growing up in poverty, they often say it was feast or famine. And you write, all I remember was famine. How did poverty shape life at home for you?
I mean, it affected everything. And we, yeah.
You really didn't have any money often, did you, the family?
We didn't. Look, my father, we had a business. We had a family business. It was a shop. We lived above the family shop. It was, most of my life, it was a two-bedroom flat above the shop for
five brothers.
Yeah, five brothers. My parents are seven of us. And the business just didn't do well. I mean, my dad actually worked really hard. My mother worked really hard. And it just didn't do that well, and it just meant we didn't have much. And any time I might want a pair of shoes for school or a school blazer or something, it was all, you know, it would be secondhand, or my mum would have to sometimes, even without telling my dad, sort of just, you know, keep the money from the till, a couple of quid or a few quid, and just sort of save it over a few months so she could buy something.
You got into a bit of petty crime, which you write about in a very powerful description. If you're honest, did you and your brother Baz steal from those fruit machines because you really needed to for your lunch money, or because it gave you a little thrill?
It did give us a thrill, and it was more than a little thrill, I've got to be honest. It was, first of all, I was 13 at the time. My brother Baz was 11. And we really thought we were onto something. And I'm glad we got caught, because it changed my life. And there's many moments probably in the book where there were life-changing moments, but that is certainly one of them, because we ended up in that police cell. Obviously, my father was furious. But a few weeks later, when we were in the police station, Bridewell Station in Bristol, my father is sitting in between me and my brother Bas, and he started crying, and I hadn't seen my father cry before, and said, you know, we've come to this country, we love Britain, Britain is the new home for my children, they're so proud to be British, and give them another chance. And the officer, he gave me a caution, but Bas had already been in trouble before for shoplifting a year before, and already had received a caution.
And your dad wasn't too impressed with that?
Oh, absolutely not. And so the police officer, actually in front of him, he had a note saying to give me a caution, and he turned the paper around, showed it to my dad, and it says to Bas, it said, convict. You know, it's a charge, actually charge. And the police officer there and then changed his mind, crossed it out, wrote caution, and it changed both of our lives. And as you say, you know, I mean, 30 years later, I'm the Home Secretary. My brother Bas is at the Strategic Command course passing out, and I'm handing him his certificate. My mother was there to see it, but I wish my dad had been as well.
Well, let's talk about your dad, because you write about the relationship with your father. He died a few years ago. He beat you. He didn't beat you up, which is a different thing. He was pretty brutal at times. You write about how you loved him. At times, did you hate him as well?
When I was getting beaten, yes. But I would say this, he was a very, very loving father, and that's how I remember him, despite what I've said and you've just said about being beaten. Who doesn't? You know, obviously, no one should be beaten, especially children. And I hated it at the time. I actually thought it was normal. So, to be honest, I thought at the time that that's actually what happens to bad children. I only learned as I got older. And after a particularly bad beating when I was 15, it all stopped. And he didn't beat me again. He didn't beat any of my brothers again. And really importantly, when I got married, soon after I got married, my dad, he asked to see me, just call me one day. He was living in Bristol. I was in London. I was particularly busy, and I said, I'd meet you halfway on the M4. He met me at a service station, and the reason he wanted to meet me was he started crying. He said, I've just been thinking about what happened, what I did, and I am so sorry. I cannot believe I did that. Will you ever forgive me? And I said, Dad, I've already forgiven you. But it meant a lot. It meant a huge amount.
You write a lot about the racism of 1970s Britain. The P word pops up many, many times in your book, and you experienced it a lot growing up. But you also talk about escaping your origins. You know, you escaped geographically. You moved to London. In the end, you didn't renounce your faith, but you moved away from the way the family practiced it. You married out of the community. You became rich through your city career. And often people who have that escape feel a sense of kind of guilt, almost like they're betraying their roots. How do you feel about your sort of, as it were, departure from your origins? You come a long way from Rochdale and Bristol.
I'm happy with the opportunities that I eventually had. And if I look back and think, you know, how that happened, I mean, despite everything, at the end of the day, what I remember is a loving family that, you know, that cared for their children, and education in my family was such a big thing. But also my parents, they were so proud to come to Britain and to be British, and they wanted their children to sort of, although they could see all the challenges that we had, you know, race issues were one of them, poverty you mentioned as well. They always told us you can succeed in this country. And I think that was ultimately true. And I still believe today, and that's what I hope from this book, that people feel that, you know, that everyone, if you can succeed in this country, and everyone has a right to sit at that top table.
How did you learn about money?
Money. I talk a bit about how being interested in sort of business and money, and it was actually my interest came about through, I used to catch two buses to school. On my second bus each day, there was someone, I never got to meet this person, but the seat was warm, so he must have just got off the bus as I was getting on. They would leave their copy of the Financial Times on the paper on the seat, and I would just pick it up because it was interesting, something to do on the half an hour journey, and I started looking at the Financial Times. That's about 12, 13 at the time, and it was talking about privatizations, and some of your listeners might remember that in the Thatcher years. And I started to think, actually, this could be a way to make money. This, you know, governments must be selling this stuff off cheap because they want everyone to make money. And so I managed to, the story's in the book, but I managed to find a way to get a bit of money from my dad and started just trading some of these shares. And it just went on from there.
When you think about the people that you grew up with who didn't make it, some of them, didn't make it sounds patronizing, so I don't mean that, but who's still poor. And who haven't gone on to be Chancellor and Home Secretary. You talk about your family values, the love of your household, but why do you think, as you look back, why do you think you made it and others, as it were, didn't manage to escape their origins, even if they wanted to?
I would say, if I picked a couple of things, I would say education, as in my parents absolutely, you know, believed in the power of education. And you know, I was the first in my family to go to university, but you know, some of my brothers followed, and that made a huge difference.
And then the other thing?
And then I would also say, just going back to that point, they truly believed that Britain was a country full of opportunities, and you know, if you go for it, you can do it, and there's that real sort of can-do attitude.
Well, you did go for it. And